Senate come to order. Messages from the House.
From the House of Representatives, February 2, 2017, message number 238. Mr. President, the following bills passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the votes indicated. House Bill number 191, Hathaway Expand Wyoming Scholarships, ayes 48, noes 12. Message number 239, House Bill number 235, Mentor Small Game and Game Bird Hunting, ayes 58, noes 2. Message number 240, House Bill number 253, Economic Development Account Funding, ayes 53, noes 7. Message number 241, Mr. President, the following bill passed the House on third reading. House Joint Resolution number 8, Federal Responsibility for American Indian Health Care, ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. Signed, Wendy Harding, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
February 2, 2017, Mr. President, your committee number 7, to whom was referred Senate File 121, Wyoming Pharmacy Act Amendments, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Agar, Case, Nethercott, Pappas, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. Mr. President, your committee number 6, to whom was referred House Bill 30, engrossed, State Parks and Sites Fees, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Barnard, Boner, Emmerich, and Moniz, Senator Emmerich, Chairman.
Drew. In case you're wondering what the Florley was saying, he said we can do anything we want, within reason. And he was, when he said we, he was referring to Ellen, of course, our chief clerk. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we're at that order of business, bills for consideration on general file.
Mr. President, during that pregnant pause, we let tension mount as we get ready to go. If I can have, Mr. President, if I can have just privilege of the floor for a moment before I make the motion?
You may.
Thank you. Mr. President, just to give the body an idea of what we're doing, and there have been a few changes on the board. It's hard to see it over there, but we've added 5 bills onto the back end. We took off one that I think will take a substantial amount. I know it would have taken a substantial amount of debate time this afternoon. The goal, ladies and gentlemen, is to get to that list today. That if we get to that list today, that will leave us about 7 to 8 bills tomorrow, a couple of which will take substantial debate. So as we go through that, that's our project for today. We'll go as long as we take. We'll be here as long as we need to be here to get it done. So please govern your comments and your debate accordingly. Make sure we have the right ideas. The other thing, just to get you, as we start, we've got some members off the floor since the last day to have bills out of committee. We've got some members that are running a bit long that had in revenue that had a pretty good workload to finish the last day. If there's a bill that comes up, we may lay a bill back, so be prepared. Please be flexible and don't be too alarmed if a bill moves back. We might change order a little bit as we go along. So with that, Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself into committee of the whole for the second to the last time on Senate files.
You heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. That motion has carried. Senator Wasserberger.
Water,
Yeah, we got some.
Anything else?
Yep.
Committee of the Whole will please come to order. First bill for our consideration is Senate File 140. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 140, I-80 Project Master Plan, an act relating to highways, sponsored by Senator Von Flatern, was referred to Committee Number 8, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Agar, Anderson, Baldwin, Christensen, and Meyer, Senator Meyer chairman. Was re-referred to Committee Number 2, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Burns, Driscoll, Hastert, and Landon, excused Senator Dockstader. Senator Landon acting on behalf of Senator Burns, chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? There are two amendments. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee in the whole rise and report, it do so with a do pass motion on Senate File 140 I-80 Project Master Plan. There was a standing committee amendment. I would ask that the reading clerk read it in at this time.
Would the reading clerk please read the amendment?
Senate File Number 140, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 5.
I would move
Senator Myers.
I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 140, and to explain the bill and the amendment, I would turn this over to the prime sponsor, Senator
Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
There's an echo in here.
Point of order. About.
So I-80 Project Master Plan, Senate File 140. This is an update of a plan we did about 2008 or 9. This one has a little bit of urgency to it because the new federal administration has asked for suggestions from our state. What are your big projects? What do you want to do? We may have some federal money because they've promised to do great infrastructure projects. And this is something new to us because they're willing to go all the way to $1 billion, with depending on the project you put in there. And at the same time, we are also doing they want to do the interchange of I-80 and I-25. So that is $300 and some million by itself. But so what we wanted to do here, and the good senator from the east over there in Goshen came up with this concept that we should probably match I-80 with the interchange. In some manner, if we're going to apply to the federal government for this money, we need to put that together as one big project and apply as such. So what this does is updates that master plan for I-80, which the last time we did it was in 08 and 9, I think, 2009, January. And so what this bill does is it goes through there. The amendment also strikes the appropriation, which I'll point out on line 1. Our page 1, line 5, providing an appropriation is struck by the amendment. So then onward we go. They do a definitions on page 2, Interstate 80, what a project is, what a project master plan is. Section 3 goes into how the YDOT, Wyoming Department of Transportation, shall conduct or contract with other persons to conduct a project master plan to enhance the safety and mobility of Interstate 80. And the project master plan shall consider but not be limited to the current and projected traffic levels, which we haven't done for 7-8 years now, especially the truck traffic. As everybody knows that drives I-80, they find the truck traffic to be quite annoying when you get in the two-lane area, which is about 90%. We have some climbing lanes, which is where you get into three lanes going one way, but mostly it's a two-lane highway. They'll also look at the high-frequency crash and road closure locations. During winter, you can hardly drive from Salt Lake to Nebraska without having been delayed by some part of the interstate being closed. Then they'll go through roadway and bridges. I think there's 335 bridges on that highway, which amazed me when I heard that number. And then they'll look at constructing additional lanes. Additional lanes may be a heavy-duty lane that can take truck traffic. That's what we've asked them to particularly look at, is something that would allow the trucks to, because a truck does the equivalent of anywhere from 4,000 to 12,000 cars, one 80,000-pound loaded truck probably does as much damage to the roadway or wears the road down about equivalent to about 4,000 cars. So we said, well, what if you built a lane that would be thicker and in made of some material that would wear at the same rate, even though all the, nothing but trucks drove on it, wear at the same rate as the other two lanes. So when we went to resurface, we'd have three lanes to resurface at the same time, and we'd save at least the outer lane, which would be cars only, would probably be in as good a shape as anything else and probably would go two overlays at this moment. Construction of additional lanes, cost comparison and reconstructing a highway using different methods, and then reconstructing the Interstate 25, Interstate 80 interchange, which was their original thought, currently available on all these control devices. And one of the good things that the senator from Goshen County said, well, what about the autonomous cars that 20 years from now, 30 years from now might be driving up and down our interstates? Do we need to look at what we need to do for them? So that's going to be in their study, too. Then they're going to try to figure out how to pay for this. So if you do a whole, today you cannot toll an existing road, but you can toll a new lane if it adds capacity and gives options for motorists to use that lane or not use that lane. So they're going to look at tolling, they're going to look at private-public partnerships, they're going to look at bonding, they're going to look everything, any way that you could pay for this project, they will look at. So basically that's what that this whole bill does, is giving them permission then to apply to the federal government with their lineup of what they think, you know, it's going to cost about $3.5 billion if they were to build another lane and reconstruct I-80 over the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, however long it took to do that. So that's what it would do. They're considering all the financials. We give them permission to apply to the federal government in this bill, consider federal funding impacts, funding sources, opportunities, and alternatives, and develop strategic strategies based on the specific improvements. All that's contained in this bill. And then you get down to the bottom. That's where the amendment plays in again, is on page 7, section 6, where we appropriated $300,000 from the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account. And the committee, that's what your amendment does. The committee removed that $300,000 along with the very beginning. They also said if they did it in-house, if you go to page, it's probably about page 7, where they struck the 217. We wanted to get in the queue right away with the federal. We wanted to be at the top of the list. So they had put an incredible date of September, it's line 6, page 7. September 30, 2017, they'd be done with this report. And the committee decided that if you're going to strike the money, they may have to do this in-house. And they said, you know, we can do some of it in-house, but we'll definitely have to do some consultants outside contracts. Well, we gave them another year. The committee struck the 17 and put in 18. So your amendment strikes the appropriation and gives them another year to the bill to complete that report. And, Mr. Chairman, I think that explains the bill, and I'll stand for questions or on the amendment. Thank you.
Questions on the amendment. Are you ready for the question?
Well, I do want to speak to that amendment. Now that we're on the amendment.
Senator Von Flader, speak to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the amendment, we're taking $300,000. Should we tell YDOT to do it? They will take $300,000 off your roads to do this study. They know the urgency. They're still going to try to match that 2017 date. Without the money in there, they probably can't. But they will take $300,000 off your roads and put it to this study so they can get into that federal queue and get in there early. So speaking against the amendment, I think we should leave the bill as is and defeat the amendment.
Mr. Senator Myers.
Yeah. Point of information, I think that in the good Vice President brought up, I think, some salient fact as far as some of the stuff concerning financing and different things like that and the different studies that have but, to on the amendment. Right. Right. And we are, because there's a need to take and have some outside consultings. We take the money off of the a lot of those funds are restricted and may or may not be able to use for consultants. So we've got a little bit of a problem there. And I'm not speaking on or against the amendment, and I'm prohibited by our rules to tell you why, Mr. Chairman, but, you know, vote it up, vote it down. It's your amendment now.
We are on Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 140. As I understand it, we have a second amendment from the Appropriations Committee, which is Standing Committee Amendment number 2 to Senate File 140. So if we're talking about money, we're not talking about Standing Committee Amendment number 1. So just one moment. Senator Von Flader.
Standing Committee Amendment number 1 is what we are on, which is striking the appropriations within this bill.
I have two amendments here.
That's fine. One at a time.
Senator Burns.
The Standing Committee Amendment from the Transportation Committee removes the appropriation. The Standing Committee Amendment from the Appropriations Committee puts it back in.
Oh, I stand corrected. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, if we do kill this amendment, then we won't need to deal with the Second Amendment at all, which is another reason to kill this amendment.
Save some time. Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question. So if they can't find the $300,000, just remind me as to what the biennial budget is for YDOT and what percentage of their budget this would be.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I don't have that at my fingertips, the overall budget of YDOT, but I can tell you that the budget that you will see next week completely removes all the general fund appropriations to this agency. And because of the AML shift that we did a year ago, there aren't a lot of general funds there for YDOT to use. So it was the feeling of the second committee that you referred to, Mr. Chairman, that if we want this study, we want it to be done in an expeditious fashion, that we fund it accordingly and don't take what little bit of general fund might be laying there off of the roads. And so on and against this amendment. Thank you.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, just an answer to one of the questions. Looking at the session laws from last time, total appropriations, everything, $229,757,033. So $229 million may have gone up or down a bit since, but that's what we show in the budget for last time.
Senator Von Flader.
And I would agree that this is a small percentage of that, but they run on about $690 million because the federal money they receive back raises the difference between the 229 that we just discussed, which is the road tax that we do garner locally and has to be applied to the roads, cannot be applied to these kind of studies, and then the fuel tax that you do receive from the federal government has specific areas we have to apply, some for the roads on the interstate, some for the state highway system. So they designate about 98% of that money, 99% of that money. And so there's very little money left. And once again, as I said, they'll take this right out of their planning budget, which have been planning for passing lanes or whatever you needed on other roads.
Is there any further debate? Are you ready for question on the amendment?
Question.
All those in favor of Senator Myers' motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 140, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Motion fails. We are back on the bill. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to withdraw the next standing committee amendment.
So noted, Senator Burns. We are back on the bill. Are you ready for question on the bill? All those in favor of Senator Myers' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 140 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 140 is passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 125. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
Anderson.
Senate File 125, Permanent Mountain Daylight Saving Time, an act relating to daylight saving time sponsored by Senator Von Flater, was referred to Committee Number 9, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Coe, Rothfuss, and Von Flater. No, Senator Perkins. Senator Anderson, acting chairman.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, I wish that they do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 125.
Senator Von Flater.
Mr. Chairman, could we have the good gentleman from Casper move the bill, not just wish it was moved?
Senator Anderson, would you move the bill, please?
I would move Senate File Number 125, Mr. Chairman. Why, I did that already.
Senator Von Flater.
Thank you.
I did that.
You wish. So, fellow senators, what this bill does, Senate File 125, Permanent Mountain Daylight Savings Times, is try to move us as a state to daylight savings, which we observe 8 months a year, and make it permanent. So we don't ever change your clocks from the spring forward to fall back part. So what this is a request to the federal government, because they regulate the time zones, that we move the state of Wyoming into central time zone and leave that as the permanent time zone, which would be the equivalent of mountain daylight savings. Quick history on this is daylight savings time originated in Europe during World War I, and it was not Ben Franklin, which is some of the people have alluded to. And World War I is a fuel conservation effort. It was originally adopted in 1918. The U.S. has several iterations of the federal policy adopting daylight savings time. The Federal Uniform Time Act of 1966 established current federal policy on daylight savings time. The Energy Policy Act of 2005 extended daylight savings time to the current time period between the second Sunday in March to the first Sunday in November. So what that means is that for 8 months a year, we would be on the same time zone as all our neighbors, all our neighboring states. So you wouldn't have an issue there. For 4 months a year, we'd be on central time. So that would keep us solid, just like Arizona is. If there is a map on your desk, shows different varying time zones. So Arizona and Indiana do not move their clocks. They stay on a set time zone. Arizona does has adopted standard mountain time. So part of the year for, 4 months of the year, they're different than us, and 8 months of the year, they're the same as us. And so that's basically what we'd be, except we'd be on daylight savings time. So right now it is 2:25. If we stayed on daylight savings time, we'd be out of here sooner because it'd be already 3:25. So we have about two. not that I would want to leave this place, but so we have to move about 200 miles, 250 miles to the east to join the rest of the group and to be considered central time. This bill also talks about, and once we did that, if we were to do that, we'd be known as Mountain Daylight Savings. State of Wyoming shall be known as on Mountain Daylight Savings Time. So the governor will have to request to move us, and then should that be passed, we will then say we'll stay on their standard time, Central Standard Time, and that's the equivalent of Mountain Daylight Savings Time, and that's all this bill does is you don't mess with your clocks. You leave them there all year long.
One thing I will mention is we worry about our kids taking the pause test and what their grades are. Just for you school people. We move the clocks about time they start the pause test. So if you feel a little jittery for a day or two as you get used to the changing of the clocks, just imagine what you do when you got a test to take all day. So with that, Mr. Chair.
It's not school funding, it's time.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to be sure. So we want to, for 4 months, we want to agree with one state, that being Arizona, but versus 4 months where we would agree with all of our contiguous states.
Yes.
Is that what we're saying?
Yep.
Okay.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman.
Then, sir,
I remember when I was growing up in Casper. Casper tried the experiment of going to a different time than what our neighbors were on. And at that point, I think they were trying to go to daylight savings time when everybody else wasn't yet. And the result, Mr. Chairman, was that half the businesses in town stayed with the old time and stayed on the time that Denver and Billings were using specifically, because that's who they were doing business with. And it was just massive confusion, because you never knew by half the town switched and half the town didn't, no matter what the law was. And you made an appointment to see somebody, you had to specify which time you were talking about, and there was lots of confusion, and it just plain didn't work. And I'm a little concerned that for the part of the year where we would be different from the other states in the Rocky Mountain region that we do business with, I think you would see a repeat of that experience. And I'm a little, more than a little concerned about this bill on that score.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, on and against the bill, and I'll explain why, is because this really does, and other states that have looked at this over time, it actually impedes the ability to do business. When it makes our business day 7 hours against our neighbor's business day of 8 hours. So you start to lose that commerce across state lines because basically we're open at different hours than they are. And quite frankly, the reason that you haven't seen a lot of states do this is for that very reason. It impacts commerce across state lines when you're doing different time zones. So, quite frankly, I'd love to stay on Mountain Daylight's time, but from the standpoint of running businesses across state lines, it just doesn't make any sense. And I don't know, is the proponent of the bill or the sponsor looked at the economic impact, or is there any data out there? But I can just tell you, that's the biggest reason that nobody else or very few people have ever done this.
Senator Burns? Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, on and against the bill, twice a year I have to ask my wife, is it fall forward and spring back, or is it spring forward and fall back? And she takes great joy in setting me straight. And anything that brings joy to her life, I'm in favor of keeping.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Chairman, actually, I think that this is probably an idea that's time, and it's ripe. I really do, Mr. Chairman. And basically, reason is that I'd like to start my day earlier every day. I really would. Because if I start my day earlier, I get a lot more done. If all my neighbors start their day earlier, I'll get a lot more done. And as to the proposition of interstate commerce, you know, there's a lot of things that happen in the central time zone and the eastern time zone that occur that basically a lot of commerce occurs before the rest of the states around here would even be getting up. And I think Wyoming would have a jump on all the rest of our mountain states. Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. I mean, because we're out there, we're putting our nose to the grindstone an hour earlier, and we're able to get in there and start, you know, our stockbrokers are actually, they show up a little bit earlier right now, but now we're going to have to get up, and we'll have the same information and be on the same time thing as the people that are enjoying commerce and doing commerce on the other side of the nation. And, you know, you talk about, and there's a lot of folks down here that go down to Arizona, you know, and, you know, it isn't that tough. Once you get down there, you know, what you do is that you just set your watch to Arizona time. It might be a little different than our time a few months out of the year. And it's fairly easy to acclimate, you know. So I guess if Arizona can do it and they're smart enough and intelligent enough to figure out how to set their clocks forward, that's fine. But the thing is that what's nice is that you never have to worry about spring forward and fall back. You're always on the time. You never miss, you know, you never have to think about, well, okay, and you're acclimated for that first 3 or 4 days on one side or the other one, and everybody that's around you is acclimated to that. You know, and it just it doesn't make sense really as far as impacting commerce to go up and to go down and to go up and to go down. If we're all at the same time zone here in Wyoming, I think that we're going to start a trend. You know, Arizona tried starting the trend, and they didn't get it right. But I think if we pass this thing through, you never can tell. Arizona just might say, hey, you know, we'll have all of our seniors, you know, on the same time zone as Wyoming. And so when we travel back and forth to Arizona, and, you know, if we get them to switch, we won't have to set our clocks or watches forward or back when we go to Arizona. And for that, Mr. Chairman, and getting me up early enough in the morning and all my neighbors up early enough in the morning, I think it's the right thing to do.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, just for a little edification from my colleague from Goshen Counties, we're talking about mountain daylight savings time, not his current banker's time that he runs on. So, you know, he could more than happily get up before 9 o'clock in the morning and start work. So, the Mountain Standard Time, Senator.
Senator Agar. Mr. Chairman, I'm here to testify. I grew up in a household that didn't change their clocks. I was raised in a state that was right on a time zone line, and so we ran on what we called Bruce time, which was my dad. And I can tell you, I turned out almost normal.
Senator Case.
Wow, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. You know, I think this is kind of a foolish argument here because there's really no such thing as time without space. Einstein proved that it's all about a space-time continuum, Mr. Chairman. But actually, though, you know, they've done these studies about what are the economic benefits of changing the time, and it was supposed to save energy. There is this story that Stalin heard that the Allies were adopting had adopted daylight savings time, so he ordered it to be implemented, and nobody ever had the guts to go to Stalin and get him to roll it back in at the time of the year, at the fall, when he was supposed to. So they stayed on the same time all the time, and, you know, they did all right, I guess, relatively under Stalin as well as you could. But, Mr. Chairman, all the studies that have, you know, it was supposed to save energy, and it doesn't. Been shown not to save energy. Changing the clocks doesn't do anything except for put the entire country into jet lag twice a year. And that doesn't seem like a very good reason to do it. Now, the thing is, yeah, you know, time's kind of a relative thing, you know. Everybody will learn to fix their own times. Business will decide what time to start their business. And you just don't have to change it twice a year. I have a stockbroker in Arizona, a friend of mine I grew up with. He makes his business adjustments to what his clients need. We would do the same thing. It would just work out. It's not that big of a deal. It'd be just really nice to change the space-time continuum and adopt a uniformity of matter and universe throughout the year. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You know, we've had a lot of fun with this, but it really is a serious issue, and this is about consistency, and it goes back to the kids, it goes back to adults. We have accidents every year changing back and forth. There's people that actually are either tired or when you hit this change, and, you know, the consistency is a huge part of what it's all about, and it's a safety issue, and, you know, we can giggle and laugh about it, talk about how it happened. But the truth is it does have direct effects on people's lives and kids' lives, with school in particular. And, you know, from that end, it makes a lot of sense. I also would represent to you, Arizona's made no move to go back into the Dark Ages. They've spent a lot of time doing this the other way, and there is no move in the legislature down there to move back into the Dark Ages. Why don't we move ahead out of the Dark Ages to the future?
Are you ready for the question, Senator Von Plater?
See the light, yes. So, Mr. Chairman, just to answer a couple of questions. One of the things, if you look at your map, it shows North Dakota. Dickinson and Williston are on different time zones. They're less than 100 miles apart, and there seems to be no economic downside to that. South Dakota is divided in half by the river, so they're mountain time on half the group and central time. So the economic argument, I don't think, plays out so well. But and then on the CASPER issue, under this Uniform Time Act, which is what we're dealing with now, a state has the authority to exempt itself from observing daylight savings, in other words, staying on your standard time, but they have to do it uniformly. The whole state has to grab it. Idaho divides itself north and south. You go to northern Idaho, you're on Pacific time. You go to the rest of Idaho, you're on mountain time. So I didn't even realize that till I actually landed in Coeur d'Alene and then realized I had lost an hour somewhere along the road. So those two, and then if you go south out of Idaho, you actually go into western time again. So it's all over the map. I will say on the energy thing, yes, they've done a lot of research and they never found out that you save energy. And according to this, a full year of daylight savings time would decrease pedestrian fatalities by 13% and decrease motor vehicle occupant fatalities by 3%. And see, it decreases traffic accidents when you stay on daylight savings times. And then conversely, an American study found that traffic fatalities increased on the day following the shifts to daylight savings times and standard time. So every time you change your clock, there was always somebody that was off a little bit and they caused a wreck or had a problem or they're sleep deprived or whatever their issue happens to be. This is a very serious issue actually for this state, so I ask for your favorable vote for this.
Are you ready for the question?
Yes.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Anderson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 125 do pass, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Division being called.
Division.
All those in favor, please rise.
Deja vu.
All those against, please rise.
What is the vote?
What is it?
Senate File 125 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 156. Mr. President, Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you please announce the vote?
Mr. Chairman, the vote would have been 16 in favor, 14 no's. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 156 with the reading clerk, Senator Agar.
Privilege of the floor for a moment.
Privilege granted.
We're joined in the back of the room this afternoon by my lovely wife. She's put up with my quirky personality for 11 years, so can we give her a quick warm welcome?
Welcome to the House.
Joey.
Welcome to the Senate. Whoa, where am I? Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 156. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File. Senate File 156, State Government Efficiencies, an act relating to administration of government, sponsored by Senator Perkins, was referred to Committee Number 2, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Burns, Driscoll, Hastert, and Landon. Excused, Senator Dockstader. Senator Burns, Chairman. Senator Landon, acting on behalf of Senator Burns, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Landon. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 156, State Government Efficiencies. There is a standing committee amendment, and I ask that that be read in now.
Senate File 156, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 6, line 13.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that there was another committee that dealt with this bill first. There are two standing committee amendments. And I believe the first committee was minerals that dealt with this. So I don't think I have position to actually move the bill.
So 131?
Yeah. Senator Von Flater.
That's the
Senator Von Flater. Are you chairman of committee?
Chairman. When the committee of the whole rises, they move that they do so with a due pass on Senate File 156, State Government Efficiencies, and to present this bill as Senator Perkins. Sorry about that.
Senator Perkins.
Anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I can, I'll deal with the standing committee amendment. In fact, both standing committee amendments deal with the appropriation on the bill. So, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'll proceed through the bill, and we'll deal with those amendments when we get to the part with dealing with appropriation. If that's with your permission, Mr. Chairman.
You're permitted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I've got I present for your consideration and the body's consideration: Senate File 156, State Government Efficiencies. Just by way of background, some of you may have this was a thought or a concept that was brought to us by a number of members of those not emanating from government. They came to us and looked because there's a number of efficiencies. There's a number of times of audits and folks that will go out there and review your processes, your procedures, your streamlining, your duplication, and find out where you've got inefficiencies, where you've got duplication, where you're spending money there's a way that you otherwise could save or not spend. And this was done a number of years ago with former, I don't know if he was a secretary or a state auditor at the time, but this was done a number of years ago, and it actually reduced the number of state agencies, I think, from significant number. It was almost by about a third to almost a half, somewhere between a third and a half. They reduced the number of state agencies through consolidation and things. And since that time, it's crept out, and it's expanded, and we've got, we have 70-odd agencies, I think, now, if I remember right from my days on appropriation. But what this has done, some of it may have been some presentations that talked about this, and so ultimately there are some people that came in and have done this in other states and saved tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars through these types of studies. And so it may be very well timed. It's always a good time, but particularly in light of our current budget statuses and our budget woes, to go back and look at this and see if there's a way to save some money. So ultimately that's what this bill is sets up and tries to do this. So instead of just turning consultants loose to run through government and do things and find efficiencies that probably won't change, the object is to create a commission and some folks to direct that work so we can do it where we know where our history and our experience has showed us we can want to waste our time, but have them focus on other places where we know that we might be willing to change and do that. I can tell you, visiting with some folks from industry, they're never pleasant experiences. Nobody likes this, but it happens. And when it's done, they're better for it. They are more efficient. They are leaner, and they see their productivity improve. So with that, I'll take us through the bill. What we have in Section 1 is we create a Spending and Government Efficiency Commission. It's created. It's got six members. There's one non-voting member, which would come from the member of the judiciary. This is on the top of page 2. And then there's three other members that come from the legislative branch, one of whom would be appointed from private industry, one from each of the houses, and one from private industry. Two additional members would be appointed by the governor's office, one from the governor's office, another one from private industry. The
all members would receive per diem and travel expenses the same manner and amount that I think legislators do. The commission will meet at the call of the chairman or the governor as necessary to complete the duties and specified as follows. The commission shall review current configurations of the Wyoming state government and duties and responsibilities of state agencies, including identifying any potential areas of overlap, any programs that have accomplished their original objectives or otherwise have become obsolete. Identify current opportunities for increasing efficiency and reducing costs through executive action or legislation. Identify areas for further study, including a recommendation of specific areas with a high likelihood of potential savings. And finally, to consider development and implementation of a program to incentivize individual potential efficiencies by state employees. So state employees get some kind of benefit if they can't come up with efficiencies that are adopted and accepted and proved worthwhile. The commission is a short-lived opportunity. The commission would have its recommendations back to the Government and Management Council by November 30th, 2017. So it's just it ends up by the end of this year, along with any legislation necessary to implement current opportunities of increasing efficiency and reducing costs, and recommendations about whether they should wrap it up or whether this ought to continue. That will come back to this body and the other body to figure out if this should go on any longer. So that also provides, on page 4, provides opportunities related to the use of consulting services to hire folks to help us through this process. And so ultimately we go through and you get to the appropriation. This happens quickly in Section 2. Before we get to the appropriation, Section 2, this happens within 30 days when the bill becomes effective. The members should be appointed and they should be off and running. Section 3 deals with appropriations of $7,800 allocated for those who are appointed from the legislative branch, $3,200 allocated to pay the per diem and expenses for those from the governor's, the executive branch. And then the big appropriation, which is where the amendments come in on the bottom of page 6, is a $500,000 is appropriated from the legislative stabilization reserve account to the governor's office to do this. I can tell you that there was significant support. In fact, that there was significant support in the committee. There were people from industries all over who recommended we do this, that this is a practice that has seen wide and effective results in not only the private sector, but also folks have done this in other states and realized significant savings. As I say, tens, in some cases, hundreds of millions, over $100 million in potential savings to do this. So with that, I'll go to the Standing Committee Amendment. The first Standing Committee Amendment was in minerals. There was
Would you allow the reading clerk to read the amendment, please?
If you think that's necessary, Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good idea.
Thank you, sir.
Senate File 156, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 6, line 13.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 156, and quite frankly, I'll ask the body to vote aye, even though I don't think it's a good idea, but I'll ask the body to vote aye because that's what we should do. So anyway, what this does is reduce the appropriation from $500,000 to $300,000. I can tell you that the next amendment is to put it back, so it's similar to we've already been through this once today. With that, I move the amendment and ask for your favorable consideration because that's what I'm supposed to do.
Senator Von Fleetern.
And thank you, Mr.
Senator Anderson.
Speaking against the amendment, we have had a couple of presentations on this very topic from different individuals, and it could cost up to $1 million. We want to do this quickly. We want to give that committee the right to spend the money as needed and to look at, you know, $500,000 spent to save minimally at $10 million, but, you know, 20 and maybe up to $100 million. We have a small budget compared to some of the large states in the world, but this would save quite a bit of money. So to have the $500,000 available to them without trying to get the governor to shift it around or to move money around to try to cover somebody's possible contract would be a tough row to hoe. And so I stand against this amendment.
Senator Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. On and for the amendment, we're asking for a very short-term commission here. We're asking for a report by November 2017, given that it's March when they get this. It's just a few months. I'm asking that they only spend $300,000 instead of $500,000. Then they are dissolved as of December 31st, 2017. So there's obviously more work to do after they make their report and are done, and somebody else has to do that, not this commission. So on and for the amendment.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, that was my question.
Thank you. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, on against the amendment, my understanding of the way this works is you're talking about contractors, private contractors who come in, and they have done this for decades in both private businesses and in state governments and municipal governments all over the country. And the fact that it is a short window of time actually is an argument for keeping the appropriation at the higher level. They don't have one or two people come in and spend that time working that. They send in as many as 40 people into all aspects of the government. And so to do this, it's kind of a shotgun approach. You have to be able to have the funding to pay for this at the time. And it's almost guaranteed you're going to make at least triple this out of it. If this is going to work, we need it to be as efficient as possible. And to do that, we need to have the funding.
Senator Hicks.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and then for a question for Mr. Vice President, when he referenced that we'd seen several presentations on this, just a clarification as to who we is, because some of us other people haven't seen those presentations, so I'm just wondering who we is.
Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. On and for the bill.
We're on the amendment.
Excuse me. Never mind.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just wondering, is this just a swag, or have we talked to contractors? Do we know actually how many people are going to show up at $300,000, how many people at $500,000? Is this based in some kind of a survey from other states who have done it, or other cities that have done it? We're essentially a large city in this state, you know. So I'm wondering what the basis of this was, or how arbitrary this number is, or what's really the basis for the $500,000.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To answer a couple of those questions, there were some presentations made in the opening days of the legislature that I think they were announced and everyone was invited to go. And there was an outside group that brought in one, and then there were a couple of different folks, the consultants that come in and do that. So you kind of have to take some of what they said with a grain of salt, because obviously there's a self-interest in making the presentation. But nevertheless, and quite frankly, I can't remember the both of them. One of them was that they wanted a $3 million contract, and then they also took a percentage of whatever savings that they had. The other one was a lesser contract. And quite frankly, this, you know, the anticipation is there's a number of groups that do this. It would be an open and competitive bid. There hasn't been any discussion that I'm aware of about this being directed at any specific group of consultants. But there are a number of folks out there that do these types of things. And I believe the good chairman of appropriations is exactly right. It's not, you don't send in some guy and he comes in and you pay him by the hour and he produces a paper report. They actually come in with a number of very competent, high paid folks, and they start through the process. And the $500,000 was obviously not $3 million. In fact, I was a little bit low of what the initial one said, but we wanted to start out as this committee, because this is a new thing, this commission, and we wanted to provide an opportunity to walk before we ran. And the other option is that there are certain things that I think that we in Wyoming recognize that we have a number of inefficiencies, Mr. Chairman. One of them, for example, we know that we could be more efficient if we didn't have 49 school districts across the state. But so far, our history has shown us that we're not willing to and haven't been willing to force those consolidations. There's no sense in allowing or permitting wasted money to go out and look at those things if we're not going to do that. So the purpose of the commission isn't just to sit by and send these folks out and say, we'll see what they come up with. The purpose of the commission is to visit with them, consult with these folks, and direct them to areas where we believe that we can do it the Wyoming way, that we'll do it effectively, and that we'll come back and that we'll have both the political will and the common sense to implement the suggestions that they have. So you can make it $300,000, you can make it $500,000, but we're talking about saving potentially tens of millions, if not $100 million in doing this. And if we're going to, it would be an absolute pity to hold this up because we didn't have enough money to get this going and off the ground. It doesn't require that all $500,000 be spent. I think that with the experiences we've had in the last little while, I think you can be sure that people are going to want to make sure this is an open and competitive bid process and that you get the best qualified bidder at the lowest price. I anticipate that that would happen. I would expect that that would happen with the state's money. And so I would encourage us to vote down this bill and just get this project underway. Excuse me, vote down this amendment and get this project underway.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, it occurs to me that some of the people that are in our system that probably have more direct understanding of the detail in more agencies than any place else are the management audit staff. And I'm wondering if there's any discussion in the committee about using the $300,000, allowing the consultants to augment with management audit staff. Those folks have gone into detail into several different agencies, into several different programs. Really, it's kind of their thing in a lot of areas to look at what we're doing wrong, how we're doing it, and how we can do it better. It seems like that's part of our system that we could prevail upon. And perhaps if it stayed at $300,000, whether or not there was any discussion about the people that do this for a living, more or less, in our system now.
Are you ready for the question? Senator Perkins.
For the question, but I want to answer that question first.
Okay.
There was some talk. In fact, in one of the committee meetings as we went through the process, the management audit committee talked about this. In fact, he's spoken earlier. If he wants to speak again, he can. But ultimately, the management audit process is a little bit different, as I understood it. I think he's awake now, and so maybe he would like to talk about how management audit interfaces and to the extent whether this is repetitive or not.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was actually an hour ahead of everybody here. Mr. Chairman, the management audit process is what they basically do is they go into a particular agency or department as required by the Management Audit Committee and will basically go through their process of what they do and how they do it. They are not designed to save money. They are designed to work more efficiently. Sometimes they're not mutually exclusive of each other, but it's for more efficient operation of that particular agency or department. What we're talking about here and what these particular consultants do is they go in and they show you exactly how to save money. And again, it's not always mutually exclusive from being more efficient, but it's always sometimes not always politically palatable what they are suggesting you do. But it's up to the committee or the commission to decide if they're going to go ahead with those particular steps or not. It's actually two completely different processes in place. In addition, with this amount of money we're talking about, the time window we're talking about, they're talking about sending in 40 people over a vast number of agencies, which is something that management audit is not in a position to do in any way. As a matter of fact, management audit has actually dropped, I think, two employees over the last couple of years now because of streamlining that we've done in LSO. Management audit actually took the biggest hit in LSO. So I don't think management audit the existence of management audit in any way takes away from what this bill is. And I will reiterate my opinion that we should put the full $500,000 in there get as much bang for the buck as you can. And it's up to $500,000. It's not a requirement.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 156, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
Motion has failed. We are back on the bill. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I would withdraw Standing Committee Amendment Number 2.
We are back on the bill. Motion withdrawn. Are you ready for the question, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I want to try an idea out in the proponents of the bill. Mr. Chairman, during campaign, I picked up quite a bit of feedback from constituents who were in a position to know that we have a major error rate in our Medicaid eligibility system that is making a lot more people eligible for the medical part of Medicaid than should be. And I've done some just very crude calculations. That's about 40% of the Medicaid budget. If the error rate's 10%, you're going to save $40 million to biennium. If it's 20%, you're going to save $80 million a biennium. If it's 1%, you're going to save $4 million a biennium, and it'd probably cost you as much to find them as that. What we need is a look at a carefully drawn sample of those eligibility determinations. I talked to the department about it. They said our electronic checking takes care of it. I don't believe it for a minute. And I've heard from other states that their experience was it doesn't. And what I'm wondering is this study and this bill the appropriate vehicle for saying, let's look in, let's do a sample and find out what the error rate is. I'm sure there's some. Find out, is it big savings or isn't it? Because it may be very big savings. But I don't know whether this is the appropriate vehicle, and that's the question I've got for the proponents of this bill. Should we consider a second reading amendment to say we're going to get into that specific item, or is that an item best left to the budget bill?
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, on the bill. I think the answer to the question is, I hope so, and I don't know. I'm more than willing to, as far as whether these folks actually look at those things, I'm willing to make an inquiry and find out at least from one of them if that's some of the things that they've done. But there's nothing magic about the language of this bill. I think it's our bill to find out and to help drive efficiencies, and I don't know that... We talk about fraud, abuse, and waste, and what this bill is trying to drive at is waste. And so I would hope so, and I believe that there's nothing magic or sacred about this language. So if we want, I think it would be wholly appropriate, I think, if we want to make sure that that's inquired into and looked at by the commission, I think this is an appropriate vehicle.
Are you ready for the question? Senator Kinski.
Question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Von Flatern's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with favorable recommendation of Senate File 156 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 156 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 165. Would the reading clerk? Wait a minute, it's 131. Senate File 131.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir?
Mr. Chairman, if we could, let's see. Hang on one second, Mr. Chairman. You ready for this? Yes. Never mind, Mr. Chairman. He got back.
What bill is next? The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 131. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 131, State Revenues and Expenditure Review, an act relating to the administration of government, sponsored by Senator Bebout. It was referred to committee number 3, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Case, Ellis, Kinski, Peterson, and Wasserberger, Senator Peterson, Chairman. Was re-referred to committee number 2, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Burns, Driscoll, Hastert, Landon, excused Senator Dockstader. Senator Landon, acting chair, on behalf of Senator Burns.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasures? Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with a do pass on Senate File 131, State Revenues and Expenditure Review. For explanation of this good bill, there's no standing committee amendments. I would defer to our good Senate President, President Bebout.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, I bring to you Senate File 131, State Revenues Expenditure Review. Mr. Chairman, I don't think we need to get into a long discussion about the situation we find the state of Wyoming in right now relative to the revenue shortage that we face and the impact it has on not only on government, cities, towns, counties, education, our entire state. And, Mr. Chairman, there are several ways to look at this. Obviously, it's a problem that we need to take very seriously. It is serious. We need to move ahead and try to come up with some kind of a plan on how we deal with that. What this particular bill does, Mr. Chairman, it sets up and creates a select legislative committee to review our state revenues and talk about what we might do or not do in terms of looking to the future. In terms of how we do that, Mr. Chairman, if you look on page 1, you can see the committee and what it's comprised of. It'll be all legislatively driven. It'll be the Speaker and the President of the Senate. It'll be Chairman of both the Senate and House Revenue and Appropriations Committee, and the majority and minority floor leaders of both the Senate and the House, and then, Mr. Chairman, a member of the House selected jointly by the President and the Speaker. So we'll have a committee of 9. This select committee shall continue to exist until March 31st of 2018. The idea, Mr. Chairman, is to bring back whatever we think we might be able to do to the legislature for the next budget session that will occur in February of 2018. And you can see the language there, Mr. Chairman, what we're going to do starting on page 2, line 6, and some of the outline things, and then line 10, subsection C. And then down to D, it says the committee shall be able to sponsor legislation for introduction in the budget session and talk about modification of revenue streams and potential additional revenue options and how we deal with those issues. There's also an appropriation of $50,000 to do that, and this appropriation will extend through the effective date of the act ending July 1st, 2018. Member of the Senate, there's different ways to look at how we might accomplish this. This is certainly one arrow in the quiver. I'd be glad to stand for any questions, but ask that you support the Senate file.
Are there any additional comments? Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm curious as to what the $50,000 is for. Is that just the per diem and the pay for the however many members it was? I guess it was 9 members or something. Is that what they're using that for?
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. That's what the money is for, per diem, and the people, the expense for those people to serve on that. One other thing, Mr. Chairman, and I have to find out if this bill survives on second reading. I don't know. There might be a need for somebody to get some outside services. I would think that would probably cover that, but I'll find out for sure.
Senator Von Flater.
Mr. Chairman, there is a committee of the whole amendment. I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
Would the reading clerk please read the committee of the whole amendment?
Senate File 131, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 3.
Senator Von Flater.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 131. And where this goes is on page 2. As soon as I find page 2, line 3, at the end of that... After the end of line 3, or on line 3, at the end of that sentence where it says 2017, insert, the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate shall be co-chairman of the select committee. And then you get down to page 2, line 23, same page, but down to line 23 at the end of that paragraph. And after projections, I think they missed the delete a period. But insert a comma, provided that no legislation shall be introduced unless a majority of the members of the select committee from each house approve the proposed legislation. And the reason for that, Mr. Chairman, is that there'll be a few more House people than there are Senate people, and we didn't want the Senate to just get rolled by a simple majority of the committee. So we wanted to make sure that it was going to be passed on both sides of the House and the Senate, before any legislation, because it does allow them to bring legislation forward. So that's the reason for it. I hope for your aye vote.
We're on Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate
Committee
File.
The whole. Committee of the Whole.
Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File 131.
Aye.
Are you ready for the question? Aye. All those in favor of Senator Von Flatern's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File 131, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no?
No.
Motion carries. We are back on the bill. Are you ready for the question?
Question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Peterson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 131 do pass, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no?
No.
Senate File 131 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 146. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 146, Community College District Board Voting, an act relating to community colleges, sponsored by Senator Nethercott, was referred to Committee Number 4, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, Rothfuss, and Wasserberger. Senator Coe, Chairman.
Senator Coe.
Chairman, moving the Committee of the Whole rise and report, do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 146 and defer to Senator Nethercott.
Senator Nethercott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, you have before you, excuse me, Senate File 146. This bill is before you because of some issues in the statutory language as it relates to the Community College Board of Trustees and how they are supposed to vote. This is really just cleanup language. If you can read there on the bottom of page 1, lines 12 through 15, you can see how that original statutory language read, and it created some confusion for any of the board members for how many votes it took to create to take action by the board. So this cleans that up. It simply states that action by the board has to be determined by a majority vote, whether there's a quorum present or the entire board. So this is simply a cleanup bill to allow for a majority vote to pass any action. Stand for questions and ask for your favorable vote.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation, Senate File 146 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Senate File 146 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 152. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 152, Hathaway Student Scholarships, an act relating to higher education, sponsored by Senator Rothfuss. It was referred to Committee Number 4, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Coe, Ellis, Pappas, Rothfuss, and Wasserberger. Senator Coe, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Coe?
Mr. Chairman, move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 152 and defer to Senator Rothfuss.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 152, Hathaway Student Scholarships, changes a little bit about how the Hathaway scholarship is distributed. We've been hearing some concerns over the last few years in the Education Committee about the lower levels of the Hathaway not really being utilized as they were intended, because as the body knows, the Hathaway has four levels of scholarship. It's got the provisional opportunity, the opportunity, the performance, and the honors level. Each of those scholarship levels provides 8 semesters of scholarship at various levels, depending on how high up you are on that ladder. And you have to use that scholarship over 8 semesters. Many of our students at the lower levels, particularly the opportunity level, would really like to be going to one of our colleges for 2 years, using their scholarship funds and then getting a certificate, getting a job afterwards, maybe having a welding degree, maybe having a CNA, something along those lines. And then they don't really have access to those final 2 years, the final four semesters, and the resources that are available. So it's not working quite as we'd like, and we have a lot of dropout after a short period of time on those lower levels. This tries to address that, Mr. Chairman. And the way it addresses it is not by changing the amount of the scholarships, but by changing how you can access the amount of money available for the scholarship. So rather than doling it out each semester over 8 semesters, a student, if this were put into effect, would have a set amount of scholarship available to them. And just so that you can see the numbers, they're on pages 7 and 8. And I'll go through the bill in a moment, but it's a little more illustrative if you just kind of take a look at these numbers. And you see for the opportunity level, you would have a total of $6,720 available to you. That's the same amount you would have available to you in statute right now. Performance would have $10,080. Honors would have $13,440. What this changes is how you bill that account. It's not released to the student, but you're entitled to it. You can then bill that account at any point over the next 6 years after you begin the scholarship for tuition and fees at any college in the state or at the University of Wyoming. So again, it's not changing the total allocation. It's just providing complete flexibility on when and where you use it, again, as long as it's towards only tuition and fees at the university or at the colleges. It's not distributed as a lump sum. You can't just go spend it. It's an account that's being billed to, Mr. Chairman. That's the concept. I'll walk through the bill and sort of demonstrate how it works. On page 2, we have amending definitions. Going on to page 3, remaining scholarship amount becomes a concept now because you have that initial total scholarship amount, Romanet 12, available. We saw those a moment ago, what those amounts would be. The remaining scholarship amount is simply what you have left that you could expend towards tuition and fees. On to page 4, conforming amendments. Top of page 5, conforming amendments. Romanet 4 is a little feature of this piece of legislation we talked a lot about. It's not directly related to the thesis, but you see beginning academic year 2017-18, the student has to have completed and filed a FAFSA, a free application for federal student aid for the academic year for which the student is applying for a scholarship. We have a lot of students that go to the university with a Hathaway and don't apply for federal aid. This actually just adds a requirement that as part of your process, you end up applying through the FAFSA, which would potentially bring more available scholarship dollars to the student. We don't have that in place right now. This is another thought we had on the JEC, but it's not directly related to the central point of the bill. Bottom of page 5 is conforming. Page 6 is also conforming. Page 7 is the language that we discussed, where we're now talking about a total scholarship amount instead of 8 semesters at a certain number of dollars, and we see that for the 3 levels going on to page 8. The eligibility requirements are simple. If you're in college, you have to maintain a 2.25 GPA. There was some variation depending on the level of the scholarship, but since we're trying to streamline that later approach about the scholarship level and just spending as you're at one of the universities or the college, it was homogenized to 2.25 as the cumulative GPA. If your GPA falls below that, you can re-earn eligibility as you could before, and then you would have access again to the account. On page 10, another big feature of this legislation has to do with the Provisional Opportunity Scholarship, which is eliminated through this legislation to help cover the additional expenses that are anticipated for the opportunity level. So to remind the body, the Provisional Opportunity Scholarship is a 17 on the ACT, not the complete success curriculum, and relatively lower requirements. The opportunity is a 19 on the ACT, performance is a 21, honors is a 25, and there are corresponding GPAs that go with it. We have had over the years some concern about the provisional opportunity on the Joint Education Committee that it's not necessarily getting or accomplishing the objectives. The concern that folks have is trying to target the career and technical education students that are interested in having access to the two-year degrees. This actually helps that group, that community, by allowing a easier access to available funds that can be used in a shorter period of time. But what this does then is it grandfathers current provisional opportunity scholars into the same program we were talking about for the opportunity, and then no new provisional opportunity scholarships would be provided as it moves forward. We have conforming language on page 10 and 11, conforming on page 12. This language here is just talking about the idea that you can use this in summer semester, fall semester, spring, January term. There's no limitation on which term you would be able to use this. Conforming on 13, conforming on 14 and 15, that's conforming the provisional opportunity. You can see the scholarship amounts on page 15. And on to page 16, we have a new paragraph which is discussing how this would be enacted and carried out, where the eligible institutions would basically be billing back to an account. That account would be managed through the Department of Education. Right now, Mr. Chairman, the Hathaway is very difficult to manage after this. In theory, it might be easier, but it would take a little bit of work transitioning. So there's an administrative burden in the transition, but the thought is just having billable accounts is probably easier than what's done right now, which is kind of an awkward calculation of a number of semesters of eligibility required, or excuse me, remaining on that that student's record. Section 2 is talking about the grandfathering of current students. So those students that are currently in one of these scholarship levels would basically get a pro rata share moving forward. So whatever they have remaining on their balance would be a balance available to them. And then on page 18, you have a continuation of that concept for the grandfathering. We've got some repealers and an effective July 1st, 2017. So, Mr. Chairman, the concept here really is to provide a lot more flexibility for our students. When the Hathaway started, the honors level scholarship covered almost all of tuition and fees. At this point in time, it's closer to about 70% of tuition and fees for the student. This provides more flexibility for utilizing those funds. It provides flexibility to the opportunity performance level to get a two-year degree fully paid for, get out, get a career. So from the standpoint of meeting the objectives of each of the tiers of the scholarship, this block grant style approach with flexibility for the student seems to accomplish that more readily, Mr. Chairman, and I urge the body to support the legislation.
Senator Landon, then Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I commend the effort on this. We've talked about this for quite some time, and I like the fact that we're trying to target an ability for our career and technical students out there. I did have a question on page 5. This requirement of the FAFSA, I guess I'm just a little puzzled as to why we have this in the bill. I'm pretty sure, Mr. Chairman, that the colleges and university require this anyway. If they don't, I still am just not quite reaching up to grab why that's in the bill. So just curious. Thank you.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I would call the Senate's attention to the fiscal note that's with the bill, which essentially says we don't know what it's going to cost. And it would seem to me that by giving more flexibility to students, which makes a lot of sense to me, we are going to increase the cost of the program, and that, I think, would necessarily reduce the awards to stay within the income. And I'm really wondering what we aren't in a position to increase the spending here. So I really wonder if this bill isn't premature, or are we going to accept that we're going to pay an even lower percentage of the tuition for the various levels? What are the financial implications of this bill?
Are you ready for the Senator Office?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to address those two questions. Regarding the FAFSA, it's not central to the thesis of the bill, but it was certainly something that's been discussed. It seems like everyone would be applying for a FAFSA, but there is no requirement. There's no requirement as a condition of getting a Hathaway or admittance to the University of Wyoming that you fill out one of these financial aid forms. Those are funds that are certainly available. This is a way to encourage that and to make sure that that's a box that's checked. That was the concept there. Regarding the tall senator from Natrona County's question about the fiscal impacts, I do expect an increase in the cost of this program, which is why the Provisional Opportunity Scholarship is limited. That's the way that the funds are intended to be balanced. In the near term, there would be an uptick, and that uptick is a concern, but it's hard to project what that uptick is going to be because the burn rate of the funds would potentially increase initially. As indicated, it's very difficult to project what that's going to be. There may be a concern there. It might be something for us to try and calculate more accurately, but in the long run, there'd be an expectation that it would either balance out or probably even have a slightly lower expenditure rate because of the elimination of the provisional opportunity level.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few more questions along that line, and we've had a lot of debate in the Senate over the last 3 or 4 years about how much money we utilize out of that fund and the actuarial soundness of it and the rate of return. And I understand your answer, my colleague from the Ivory Tower, but I really need to know a little bit more about what that impact might be. One of the other questions I have, and you may have said this, and if I missed it, I apologize, but on when we talk about these amounts that we now put into statute, are those amounts the amounts that would be anyway, or are they different than they would have incurred? I think that's really important. The last thing that it really doesn't have anything to do with this necessarily, unless I missed it, but a lot of times people that have these scholarships have other scholarships, and in any way, shape, or form, does that affect those offsets? Because what we certainly don't want to do is a fund that's having trouble paying for what it does and then provide more money to them, and then, in fact, they have other scholarships or they're making money on it. I want to be sure we're not doing that.
Senator Driscoll.
Some along the same line, going back to the honors, down to 70%. I'm fairly positive there's a bunch of people making money going to college. I've talked to a number of them. I'd like to know how many if we could find it. We're going to eliminate the provisionals. I want to know what group of kids gets hit with these and what we're going to have happen to them when it's gone. As I understand it, these have been the bottom, and all of a sudden we created a scholarship program to help disadvantaged kids that really couldn't get into the program. And now what we're doing is turning this into an honors program that really accelerates the top end and leaves that bottom end to underprivileged kids left out again. And I've got grave concerns if we're leaving a group at the bottom of this that's exactly the ones, and I realize it's a higher dropout rate, but I want to explain what we're going to do about them, because what we're doing is eliminating an opportunity for them to succeed at all. The last one is you talked about the 2.25 GPA, and it used to have some other provisions. Those aren't in the bill, and I want to know what we've done, if we've softened up GPA requirements to hold this, or what actually was there, because that piece isn't showing in the bill, or I don't find it there. Thank you.
Senator Perkins.
So anyway, just to follow on with a couple other additional questions is, if I understand the discussion about the FAFSA application so far, my understanding is FAFSA doesn't have any effect on Hathaway. This is an incentive. It's an incentive to do it. Basically, it makes it a requirement to get it. And so, but FAFSA itself doesn't have any effect on Hathaway. And so, ultimately, I just wanted to make sure that was true. I'm seeing a nodding of the head, but that's one question I had. With respect to removal of the opportunity, is there any opportunity? I mean, Remember the discussions we had as we kind of put some of this stuff into place years ago with respect to opportunity scholarship levels. And, you know, I remember a lot of the discussion had to do about late bloomers, you know, folks that you know, kind of didn't really catch the vision of what school was about until the last, you know, senior or junior year of high school, and then they kind of moved in. And I'm wondering, is there any way for someone to kind of leverage themselves up if they kind of didn't really catch the vision until the last year or two of school with respect to the overall grade point average would have qualified them for an opportunity, but they're not going to qualify for it now. But given on recent performances, is there a way to shoehorn in or earn in a scholarship later on so that they could participate? Anyway, I think I know the answer to that. The answer is probably no, but I'm just wondering about that. And the last question I have is, if I understand the way this would work, you've got this, you know, instead of saying you're kind of fixing the amount, instead of kind of having it, you're fixing the amount, and then they're able to draw that down faster, and if I understand what the bill does. So the way I think this would work is ultimately, my experience is that, you know, why would you worry about year two or year three if you're struggling to stay in college in year one or two? And so I think the result of that is you draw down your share of the scholarship in earlier years, which is going to leave you short in the out years because you run out of scholarship money, but you're still going to have tuition fees and stuff due in the out years. So I wonder if that creates a kind of a natural budget cliff or budget crisis for people in their last year or two of college by doing it this way. And then I wonder if there's any discussion about that. Coincident with that will be, part of the way that you have to do this, remember that we funded that the Hathaway Scholarship Program is a permanent fund of the state. And so it's self-funding. We don't really appropriate to that other than we appropriate the earnings out of the Hathaway fund to pay for these things. And I think if I understand this way, that will cause early acceleration, which will decrease the amount of money that can be invested and ultimately would end up decreasing your rate of turn because that money will be pulled. You'll be pulling it out in the first two or three years at a faster rate than you would have where there was ratable distribution later on. And that'll affect the overall earnings of the fund. And I think that's going to be one of the issues of how that affects the solvency of the Hathaway permanent fund. I can tell you that in our conversations at the Select Capital Finance Committee this summer, the treasurer believes that fund is insolvent, but the treasurer, in his analysis, he assumes that you'll never receive any capital gains. So, I don't know that I agree with his, but ultimately we want to be careful because we don't supplant this with general funds. This is solely off the earnings of the permanent fund. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was not able to sit in on committee, and I know you probably had a good conversation about this. I can't answer all the questions. I know the sponsor will be able to, but I did want to speak a little bit to my friend from the tower. We've had conversations over the past couple of years, Mr. Chairman, about that particular group of students and trying to figure out how we can best invest our state monies in their opportunity. Those provisional opportunity students, I can't tell you sitting in a dean's office in my previous life how many times I'd have a visit with somebody and say, well, what are you doing here? And several times they would look at me and say, well, I had this free money, so I thought it would just get me a dorm room and come down here for a little while. And that kind of concerned me, and that's what kind of initiated some of the conversations we had on our Joint Education Committee over the years, is what could we do to better invest these funds and help these students to be successful? I guess if I read the bill right, I don't believe that we're dropping that opportunity out from underneath them. I think what we're doing is allowing them to take a look at some career and technical programs that might be more expensive. They can invest those monies in those 2 years and try to be successful instead of trying to pigeonhole them into an academic program that they really don't have that kind of interest for. I too have a little bit of reservation about the impact on our Hathaway funds, and if this is going to front end load and be too much of an impact, that's going to concern me. But Mr. Chairman, just some thoughts on that provisional level. Thank you,
Senator Raffas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To catch up here, we've got a few excellent questions and good discussion. I appreciate it. The first concept from the president about projecting out and trying to get more data and more analysis, and we heard that from senators from Trona County as well. I think that's a good point, and we'll try and do some math if this moves forward, try and do a better job of projecting what that might be and what it might look like and what the drawdown might be. The reality is, in the long term, with the elimination of the provisional opportunity, there's a substantial savings there that can offset the additional burn rate in the beginning. However, the grandfathering aspect of it, I think, is the biggest concern, because while we're grandfathered, we have effectively a double up. We've got the increased burn rate, but we've still got in place the expenditures, and at that point there might be trouble that we need to look at. So I'll try and dig into that a little bit better and see if I can make some estimates of what that might cost. Regarding whether or not the values here are the same or different, they are the same. It is 8 times the number that was previously in statute, so the total available funds to the student is the same total available funds. It explicitly says in statute now and continues to say with regard to other scholarships that this is a top-off availability, which is towards only, it's only towards tuition and fees. So if you have other tuition and fee-only scholarships, then you can't apply them both at the same time. However, there are other scholarships that would cover books, that would cover room and board, going towards that total cost of attendance, which I think we all know is close to around 3 times the tuition. And you can have scholarships going towards those, but you can't be doubling up on the tuition and fees. So what would end up happening is those funds would stay in your bank account. To my friend from the Devil's Tower area, looking at what we're doing with this group of students, it's difficult because we have 2 groups of students in the lower 2 tiers. We've got the provisional opportunity and we've got the opportunity. Provisional opportunity at an ACT score between 17 and 19 and at the GPA down where it's at really have indicated by testing that they're not ready for school. That's what a 17 to 19 ACT means. College ready is around 20 as your composite. So until you've received a score of 20 on the ACT, the ACT is actually saying you're not college ready. So even those that receive the opportunity at a 19 ACT are folks that the ACT say are not ready for college, but that's still an available scholarship. The concern is we have 2 levels, neither of which work because both of them exist. And it's a difficult trade-off, but the intent of this is to make one of them work exactly as it's supposed to. Make sure that those individuals who really want the opportunity, who've completed the entire success curriculum, who've earned a 19 ACT, between a 19 and a 21, and have greater than that 2.5 GPA in school, have sufficient funds and resources available to them to get them through that degree in a community college or first 2 years of the university in that instance. It is a trade-off. And as far as what's available to the rest of the groups, those that are between 17 and 19, to be perfectly honest, it's a policy choice, and there's nothing left standing after this is fully implemented in a couple of years. So the choice is 2 programs that are broken, which is the state right now, or 1 program that works for half as many. It's a policy choice, and again, it's something we looked at a lot on JEC, and we've had so much testimony about how difficult it is with this provisional opportunity, not having a success rate, but having a lot of resources directed at it, that it seems to me and the co-sponsors that having a working program at that opportunity tier would be more valuable than just continuing our two broken programs that have not paid dividends to the state.
Are you ready for the question?
No, Mr. I wish we were, but
I'm sorry.
But
I'm sorry,
Chairman,
Senator Ruffus. I thought you were done.
Mr. Chairman, I was just pausing to move on to the next question set. It's not my fault that a lot of questions were asked. I didn't ask them. Mr. Chairman, with regard to the involvement of the FAFSA, it is entirely independent of the Hathaway. It was sort of an add-on. I don't mean to confuse everybody with the addition of that in the legislation, but it was another thought that went into this area of the legislation, and it was something we talked about during the interim on the Education Committee. With regard to moving up the ladder of the Hathaway or leveraging up if you performed badly, going to the majority floor leader's question, there has not ever been any mechanism in the Hathaway to allow you to move up a level. When you're at a level, that's your level. It's based entirely on your high school performance. You don't move up or down. You can lose eligibility while you're in college or at the university, but you can't move up or down. There has been legislation proposed at different times throughout the history of this program, but none of it has successfully been implemented or put forward, and this legislation does not change that in any way. If you earn a performance level is your level throughout college, as it would be under this case. Regarding the expenditure rate and whether you would just burn through your money early, this was a point of discussion, and this goes back again to the majority floor leader's question. The discussion about this is how you would really want to do it. And if you think about it at different levels, when you're at the lowest level, the opportunity level, it buys you 2 years of college. That's what it's intending to do. That's the success story. So that seemed like a reasonable outcome. Burning through at the performance or opportunity, if you're looking for a four-year degree, you certainly could burn through rapidly and end up at the honors level with paying for 3 years of tuition and fees. So as it stands right now at the honors level, you would go through 4 years and you'd be short each year. You'd have to make up that gap, and you might make that up through additional revenue, through your savings, or through a college loan. So you'd have 4 years of college loans over that period of time. If you've completed 3 years of college, you have momentum typically to complete, and you would end up taking out 1 year of college loans if you did not have any significant additional scholarships available. But since the scholarships are offsetting the Hathaway, then you might have remaining funds available if you had additional scholarships. So in terms of which is the more convenient way to do it if you are an honors student, if it were me or if it were my kids, I would want to have the full flexibility, spend for 3 years and take out 1 year of college loans and then come right back and start paying off those college loans. That would be the most cost-effective approach, which this allows, but you can't do right now. You have to file for 4 independent years of college loans if you have shortfalls each of the years under the current circumstance. Mr. Chairman, I think that's the end of the list. So I'll sit down now, and we'll see what the next list generates.
Senator Driscoll.
Oh, a few more questions and some thoughts. It seems like we've been pretty successful on the dropout deal that doesn't work, which is, in truth, is an accelerated program, and now we're going to move into the upper levels and let them see how fast they can spend the money, and if they drop out, now we've lost bigger chunks of money because they've now blocked granted accelerated. My main questions come back to, one, how many kids have been in number-wise in all four of these divisions? I don't need this today. I can have this on second, but what are the four levels? What has come in and out of them as far as what they've done? And then I want to know, when we combine these, what the changes are to the entry level to get into it. We've obviously raised some standards going from the provisional to the opportunity. They're going to have some different standards to get in. I want to know how many kids we're going to drop back out, because my definition of success and the committee's may be slightly different is for a big group of kids that were going to be college graduates anyway, which I happen to have some in my family. They're going to go through whether they got scholarship or not, they're college bound. Success might be a pretty small percentage rate of first-time college graduates that their kids forever are the same as others. You know, it tends to be people that have graduated college, their kids go to college and succeed and get out. For every one of them, we block out. And those are ones that probably their kids aren't going to go to college either, and I think we're missing some opportunities there. The other question I have is in this 17 to 19 group, we got a K to 12 system that's 100% college bound. How many kids are we leaving in this 17 to 19 point group that we're telling them, look, you're not ready for school, you're not ready for anything? What are we doing to address that? And shouldn't the Hathaway have some way to try to address that? Because this is a second level of failure in our high school system, and I don't blame it on the high schools. How are we going to deal with this going forward? Because that's part of what the Hathaway was for, to get those chinned up, and now we're saying we're going to cut another layer off the bottom and tell you, go out and do something. You're not fit for college, and you can't get there.
Are you ready for the question, Senator Roth?
Mr. Chairman, just very briefly, I'll try and get some answers to those specific statistics for the good senator from Devil Power.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 152 do pass, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 152 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 150. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's about 10 minutes to, or quarter to four. I've moved that the Committee of the Whole beg leave to rise and sit again out in about 10 minutes.
Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
You heard the motion.
You have heard the motion. As soon as I get back from the restroom, we'll pick this right up.
Aye.
Aye.
He's gone.
His eyes get yellow.
Out the door.
Okay.
15 minutes up on adjournment. Okay,
I saw you in there talking.
I'm really half surprised that this feels.
Yeah, there's a team in Campbell County around.
I get this handed out. I have copies, but I didn't sign. I only signed this one copy. Is that okay or not? Or do I need to put my signature on all of my? Probably do, don't I? Okay, thank you.
This was the second time. It's not part of the item. It's yesterday.
Was it really?
Yeah.
This is my favorite.
Why it took so long.
pass 152.
Yes.
Yes, we're on 153, but we're going back in as systemic, and we're going to read in reports, and then you'll be called back.
Okay.
Okay. Do you have a minute?
I have a while.
Wherever you are.
You want to just start, Alan?
Out of the committee, House of Origin, get that applied to re-referral to appropriations.
Got to be out of appropriations.
Do it. So,
let's see, hang on one second.
236 House. It came out of the Education Committee. They're going to refer it to appropriations today. They're going to kick it out today.
They kick it out today. I think they're on the same time schedule. No, wait a minute. Hey, they're on a different time schedule.
They're all there on a different schedule.
Hey, Drew, hey, what's the...
We roll the world, we, yeah.
I can look at the calendar.
They have a different schedule for bills out of committee. I think...
Will the Senate come to order, please?
Drew, isn't that right? Bills out of House Committee next Wednesday.
We have reports to read.
Yes.
We have a quorum.
January 2, 2017, Mr. Presidential Committee Number 3, to whom was referred Senate File 124, Taxation of Sale and Lease Transaction. Respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Case, Ellis, Kinski, Peterson, and Wasserberger, Senator Peterson, Chair. Mr. Presidential Committee Number 3, to whom was referred Senate File 157, Education, Continuing Contract, Teacher Status, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Case, Kinski, and Peterson. Noes, Senators Ellis and Wasserberger, Senator Peterson, Chairman. Mr. Presidential Committee Number 12, to whom was referred Senate File 28, Revisers Bill, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Hastert, Perkins, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern, excused Senator Bebout. Senator Bebout, Chairman. Mr. Presidential Committee Number 3, to whom was referred Senate File 95, Early Retirement, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Case, Kinski, and Peterson. Noes, Senators Ellis and Wasserberger. Senator Peterson, Chairman.
That clears this.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. I would ask that Senate File 95, Early Retirement, sponsored by Senator Meyer, be re-referred to a committee number two, Appropriations.
Seeing no objections, so ordered.
Thank you.
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, privileged floor.
You may.
The back of the room is Rachel Derner, my aide from 2 years ago down here, who is now a sophomore in ag at UW and is a Farm Bureau intern this year. Full ride scholarship at UW with top end of the Hathaway. Great student, great person. Right. Please join me in welcoming.
Welcome. Any other business? Seeing none. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. I move that the Senate resolve itself back into committee of the whole.
You've heard the motion. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion's passed. Senator Wasserberger. You're on.
Thank you, Senator. Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 153. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 153, Employment Non-Discrimination, an Act Relating to Labor and Employment, sponsored by Senator Raffas, was referred to Committee Number 9, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Coe, Perkins, Raffas, and Von Flatern. No, Senator Anderson. Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Von Flatern.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 153, Employment Non-Discrimination, and to explain this great bill, Senator, would you call on Senator Raffas?
Senator Raffas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 153, Employment Non-Discrimination, it's a short bill, but it's a big topic. We, the Senate, considered very similar legislation 2 years ago. Most of us were here. Some of us were not. The central issue, the most important aspect of that prior legislation really was the employment aspect of it. It was broader 2 years ago to provide that gender identity or sexual orientation would be added to the protected class list throughout Wyoming statute. So everywhere where there was a protected class list, that piece of legislation added sexual orientation or gender identity. In this legislation, it does exactly the same thing we did 2 years ago, but it focuses, again, only on the employment non-discrimination portion and captures the same language that we saw 2 years ago and brings it forward into this legislation for us to consider again. Mr. Chairman, if we go through the bill quickly, we see on page 2 definitions of gender identity, religious organization, sexual orientation. These are the same that we saw 2 years ago. The religious organization is going to come into play when we get to some religious exemption language that we had previously crafted and bring forward in this legislation. But at the bottom of page 2 and on to page 3, we see prohibition on paying employees less for the same work. So this is a fundamental concept of fairness. This is something that we have in statute right now indicating that you cannot pay less for work on a basis of gender, that you cannot have a wage gap, that that's a discrimination, and you see in the paragraph A that no employer shall discriminate on that basis. This legislation would add gender identity or sexual orientation to that list, prohibiting discrimination for payment for the same work based on gender identity or sexual orientation. And once again, it's reiterated for conforming language in Romanet 4. The bottom of page 3 onto page 5 talks about further limitations on discriminatory and unfair employment practices. And this talks now in Romanet 1 on the bottom about hiring, discharging, promoting or demoting, or discriminating in other manners based on a series of protected classes that we've seen in previous legislation before, where we're seeing qualified disabled person or any person otherwise qualified because of age, sex, race, creed, color, national origin, ancestry, or pregnancy. This legislation would add to that list, after sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity, Mr. Chairman. And then you see, again, conforming language on Romanet 2 below, indicating that it's prohibited for a person, an employment agency, a labor organization, or its employees or members to discriminate in matters of employment or membership against any person from those same protected classes where we would be adding sexual orientation or gender identity. The bottom of page 4 and on to page 5 includes some specific language in 27.9 talking about a religious exemption where you can see the following shall be exempt under this article from employment practices relating to sexual orientation and gender identity, where Romanet 1 would be a religious organization. Romanet 2 is an expressive association where that's further described under paragraphs A, B, and C, where the primary purpose and function are grounded in religious teachings. It is not organized for private practice, and employment activities would otherwise be subject to this article. And finally, a key provision in D, whose right of expressive association under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution would be significantly burdened by application of this article or by any other provisions of law related to discrimination in employment. Mr. Chairman, you may recall that this language was language that was used in a city ordinance in a state to the east of us and was successful in that instance and seems to include a lot of the concerns and considerations that we've heard raised. And there's further provisions in F that goes takes it one step further to indicate clearly that nothing in this article shall be interpreted to require an employer subject to this article to give preferential treatment to any employee or applicant because of the employee's or applicant's sexual orientation or gender identity on account of any imbalance and so on. The key concept there is that it's protection from discrimination, not preferential treatment. And I think we've probably all heard concerns that this is supposed to be generating some type of preferential treatment. This explicitly indicates, Mr. Chairman, that is not the case. We're not talking about a preference. We're talking about equal treatment in the workplace. So the same work generates the same salary, regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity. You don't discriminate for promotions. You don't discriminate and fire. You recognize that it's the work that matters. And that's the Wyoming way. That's what's fair. I recognize that there's a lot of concern about protected classes, the whole structure of this statute. I've had conversations with many of you about the idea that protected classes are difficult. They lead to lawsuits. It's hard. It's confusing. But the reality is this is the statutory structure that we have to work with. This body certainly didn't choose it, Mr. Chairman. It's been in place for a long time. This is how we protect against sexual discrimination. This is how we protect against racial discrimination. And we know and understand at this point in time that we see discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity in not only our state but other states throughout the country. And this is the method that we have available to help protect those individuals. The federal government through the EEOC has already recognized this protection. But our Department of Workforce Services is unable to provide that protection because we don't have statutory language that gives them the authority at this point. So in many circumstances, we have to just refer individuals that are being discriminated against in our workplace to another state so that they can seek redress. That's not fair. We have to send them south to talk to some people, to work with the EEOC to try and get things done. This allows them to work within our system. It provides the authority of the Department of Workforce Services. But, Mr. Chairman, one of the things that this really does is show that Wyoming is open for business. We are a state in need of economic diversification and investment from many corporations in many different areas of business and industry. And we want to make it very clear to those corporations that we are a 21st century company that protects workplace rights. It's not just about those companies' employees that are coming here. They want to know that their employees' family members are also protected. And this tells those companies that we will provide that protection, that the state of Wyoming does not just rely on the federal government to take care of business, but that we, the state of Wyoming, will actually take care of business for them and welcome them to the state, regardless of their race, creed, sex, color, sexual orientation, gender identity, or anything else, because what we care about is equal pay for equal work, and we respect the job. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Doc Stater.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up. I think you're referencing the language. I think you're in that state. That might be your other east, Senator. A couple other questions. Why did we separate it out from the last, as long as we brought up previous legislation, why did we separate it out this time? And then over on page 5, little conversation on significantly burdened and imbalance in the total number. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Plater.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not equipped to quite answer those questions yet, but I will bring up the fact that there's about 5 cities that actually did resolutions. This is the way they do business. This is in their policy, but they didn't want to make it because the state had never run it as a part of the statutes. They didn't want to do it themselves, but they did run a resolution. One was Rock Springs, Casper, Cheyenne, and Gillette for sure, and I worked with Gillette. I can't remember. I think there's a 5th one in there. But I did work with the Gillette group. They did run a resolution. And I told them, because we failed a couple of years ago to pass this exact legislation, much more expanded, and that's one of the reasons I believe that we reduced this one, was to make it less expansive and maybe more palatable to some. But I can tell you the city of Gillette was very glad. And we got almost 4, we got 6 out of the 7 voted for it on the city council. So this resolution, this legislation, we need to be open for business. This is a good move.
Senator Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question, and I'm trying to remember. I think the Civil Rights Act has an exclusion, 64. The Civil Rights Act of 64 has an exclusion in all the information and the groups that they have in there, but excludes small business, like either 10 or under or 15 or under. What does this bill do in regard to the Civil Rights Act and how it's treated at our nation, national level?
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against this bill. I was the only vote in committee against the bill. In the committee, we heard some interesting testimony. I'm opposed to it because it establishes 2 new protected classes. I was opposed to the military spouses because they proposed a new protected class also, so I'm also opposed to this bill. In testimony, we heard that there is no protection for schools that are religious but are not affiliated. We have religious affiliation schools but not others. The other thing we heard from another testimony was that New York City now recognizes 31 gender identities. And, of course, the presenter was talking about how it grows and grows. So on and against the bill.
Are you ready for the question? Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, just wanted, you should have a handout on your table. It's called USDA Non-Discrimination Statement. And members of the body, just to take off where the good senator from the Trona County left off down there about growing and growing and growing. So this is what your U.S. government does right now. So if you look at that, it basically picks up the original ones as outlined in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which was discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. And then it picks up gender identity, including gender expression, sexual orientation, disability, age, marital status, family and parental status, income derived from public assistance programs, political beliefs, or reprisals or retaliations for prior civil rights activity. I'm just wondering, if we prescribe to the argument that by expanding additional protected classes or bring in additional protected classes for two to be business friendly within the state of Wyoming, well, why wouldn't we include all these other potential classes that are enumerated in the USDA's non-discrimination? And I guess that's the point I'm trying to get to. There's just no end to it. At what point are we going to continue to add special classes into the non-discrimination? And just one quick question I do have for the sponsors on the legislation is, when we use the terminology employer, does that include public sector employers or all private and sector employers? How broad is that definition of employer? And, well, with Mr. Chairman, I guess that's my concerns. It just won't be a never-ending list, but I would like some discussion on who's covered under the definition of employer.
Are you ready for the question, Senator Rothfuss?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to answer a couple of those questions, I appreciate the discussion and debate. To the President's question about the number, and there is a minimum of 10 in the 64 Civil Rights Act. The state has a different minimum, and I'm hesitant to say the number because I haven't confirmed it recently, but I know that it's less than 10. I'll get that number, and if this moves forward, I'll certainly provide that to the President. But this legislation does not in any way affect that number. We have that as a standard number for when the employment provisions kick in. Definitely lower than 10, but I'm not certain of what that is at this point. Regarding a couple of the arguments that we heard in committee about how this would not cover a religious school that was unaffiliated, Mr. Chairman, I don't know why anyone would conclude that based on the religious exemption language, but if there's a way to tighten that up, you know, I'd be happy to work with the concerned senator or any other senators to do so. Finally, regarding who this covers, whether this is public employees, private employees, again, it covers certainly all public employees, but it does cover employers. It covers private employers as well, and it goes back to the President's question about what the minimum number is for that private employer, and I'll look into that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for this piece of legislation, you know, as a small businessman, I deal a lot with a lot of consultants from many parts of the United States. I partner with people in Seattle and Chicago and Denver and all over. And I really get feedback from folks that, you know, we're not an inclusive state. And frankly, you know, no matter what your feelings are about these issues, I believe that we should not be discriminating against anyone. Certainly not in the workplace. You know, if the exemptions for the religious organizations, you know, I personally have a faith is not congruent with a lot of these things, but I certainly in my workplace would not discriminate against anyone who believes differently than me. And so I just believe that we need to think about who we are here in the Equality State and live up to our slogan or our logo or whatever you call it. We need to be the Equality State again. We need not to discriminate against anyone. On and for the amendment or the bill.
Senator Anselmi Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for the bill, as a business person, it doesn't bother me to, as I said before, track generally the federal anti-discrimination. But secondly, as a woman, as a business owner, as a native of this state, I think it's time for us to say to our young people, we embrace you, we welcome you, we accept you, and we're not that kind of place. I agree with my good senator over here. It's time for us to open our arms and be the Equality State.
Senator Kinski, and then Senator Nethercutt.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. First, I'd like to just reframe this debate a little bit. And I'm going to resist the popular notion about in the land that votes on these kind of bills are either a vote for discrimination or against discrimination. We can be an open and tolerant and accepting society and still not support this bill. I mean, Roger Williams founded Rhode Island on the premise that he was going to be a tolerant society and accepting of people of all faiths and all creeds. They didn't have any laws that mandated it. It was a tolerant culture. And tolerance is different than accepting or endorsement. And I think every one of us here can feel that we're tolerant, welcoming, and accepting people, but still have reservations about this kind of legislation. And I grow weary of the workplace being the government's instrument of social engineering. And that's where we are. The government can't eradicate poverty, so it legislates minimum wages, hoping that the employer can do what the government cannot. The government makes the employer on the front lines of these discrimination lawsuits. And it's tough enough to make a living. This is not 1965. I could see in 65 the need for a lot of this remedial legislation, but society has changed. The other thing is I have a great deal of reservation about Wyoming's discrimination statute and the way it's written. In a previous bill, we talked about the fact that federal law is 10 or 15 employees, Wyoming's is 2. Federal law has certain penalties, far less than the scope of the penalties under Wyoming's law. Federal law says you can get back pay up to 2 years. Wyoming doesn't limit how many years of back pay you can get under these statutes. And then federal law does not provide that you can get future pay as damages. Wyoming's does. And I am just reluctant to expand anything under Wyoming's discrimination code until we have a chance to come back here and look at this law and pare it back to something that's far less onerous than it is. Since we spoke about the legislation 2 years ago, I will mention that at that time I brought an amendment to reform the process and the penalties under Wyoming's discrimination law, and it was objected to as not germane. But I continue to have the objection to anything that opens up more protected classes, given how onerous Wyoming's not just penalties, but its process is. There is a city to the southwest of us that has a provision for discrimination that says, one, you must give actual notice to the management as opposed to somebody just being canned or quitting and saying, I just felt put upon and I told the guy at the next desk. That's all it takes for notice under our law. Actual notice to the management, an opportunity for mediation, and penalties that are far less onerous than we've got here in Wyoming. The reason that's important is because those of you who have experience in the workplace know that all too often how these well-intended statutes really work. Sometimes it's for an instance of actual discrimination. More often than not, if you look at how many of these complaints are ever actually sustained in Wyoming, more often than not, the fact pattern is like this. You have a poorly performing employee. You've written them up. You've got them on an improvement plan. And then they decide to file a discrimination complaint, either before termination or immediately after. Okay? So now what do you do? As an employer, you drop everything, you lawyer up, and you usually write a check just to make the thing go away because you cannot risk a potential loss, guilty or not. And more often, just the process of going through the discrimination complaint, having to get a lawyer, having to go to the hearings, is $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000. So usually there's a nuisance settlement, and they go away. Now, it's rare, and I think those of you who have been through it, it's rare that the employee... that there's any question that the employee was not performing and the complaint was simply a matter of harassment or delaying tactics against the employer. And I think before we crack this thing open and add any more protective classes, we've got to remedy that aspect of this discrimination law on and against the bill. Thank you.
Senator Nethercott.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to echo the concerns of the senator from Natrona County. Vote it up, vote it down, but I do think it's important for the body to know what the trend is across the country when it concerns the definition of sex, which is currently illegal under Wyoming law. So to discriminate against somebody on the basis of sex in Wyoming is illegal. What has been happening across this country is significant litigation concerning this issue for sexual orientation and or transgender. And so how the federal circuits are ruling is to hold that to discriminate against somebody on the basis of their sexual orientation is to discriminate them against them on the basis of sex. So it's already provided for in law. Real briefly, some of those federal circuits are the 1st, the 4th, the 6th, the 7th, the 9th, and the 11th. That's an incredible amount of federal circuit courts that have held that to discriminate against somebody because they're transgender is to discriminate against them on the basis of sex. Additionally, these state federal courts have also held the same. Nevada, Connecticut, Michigan, North Carolina, Maryland, Alabama, Pennsylvania, Indiana, New York. The logic for this court's reasoning is really as followed, and I can provide kind of an illustration for what that looks like. If I'm an employer and I have male employees and I have female employees, and they both wear lipstick, but I only discriminate or I terminate the male employee for wearing lipstick, is my problem with the lipstick, or is it because he's a male with lipstick? And so the issue there, the dispositive fact, is the sex, because I'm not discriminating against the female employees for wearing lipstick. That's generally the logic of the courts. So my legal opinion is, when I consult my business clients about this, is you cannot terminate against somebody or discriminate against them because of their sexual orientation. It's against the law. And that's exactly how the federal EEOC laws are interpreting it, and that's how the courts are interpreting the definition of sex. You will see in this legislation before you, it's pretty complicated. It goes beyond just providing another classification for a protected class. There's this whole provision in here regarding the definition of religion, which I urge you is a pretty scary proposition when we start defining religion in statute. The reason why this looks so differently than other proposed bills adding protected classes is because this is a unique issue for our courts and for our country at this time, where we have two different competing interests going against each other, those of the religious organizations who may find that it violates their religious beliefs to be told that they have to do certain acts on the basis of sexual orientation. That's most commonly understood in the Colorado Bakery case, where you heard of the case where the Colorado Bakery owner refused to sell a wedding cake to a gay couple. That case is currently in the process of going to the United States Supreme Court. In my conversations in talking about this bill, I have urged everyone to slow down and to wait for guidance from the U.S. Supreme Court, because I believe that we will get it. And the court will provide the guidance as it relates to religious discrimination as well as sexual orientation discrimination. It's my belief, based on the trend of the courts, the incredible trend of the courts, that to discriminate against on the basis of sexual orientation or transgender status is illegal. It is defined under sex, which is currently illegal under Wyoming law. So vote it up, vote it down, but I do think it's important to have that larger, broader legal perspective about this particular issue.
Question being called. Senator Raffes.
Mr. Chairman, I again appreciate the debate. I wanted to address a couple of the concerns. The first concern by my friend from Sheridan really is about the entire statute related to workforce and labor law and a general distaste for it, which I understand. There are certainly problems with it. This legislation is not the fault of those problems. This legislation seeks to address discrimination against individuals for sexual orientation and gender identity. It does not seek to cure the entirety of the workforce law and labor law in Wyoming. It doesn't attempt to. I can't imagine doing that in this short of a bill, and I would be happy to work with the senator on trying to do that in the future. We've talked about it for a couple of years. Let's try to tackle that. Let's try and do a better job and put together some legislation that remedies some of those interests that we've heard. But that's certainly not a reason not to reach out and protect those of our individuals who are being discriminated against based on gender identity or sexual orientation. With regard to my good colleague from right here in Cheyenne, the idea that we seek directions from federal courts to solve our problems is something that I'm not comfortable with. Not only that, but the Tenth Circuit Court does not appear to have a ruling on this. It is clear that the federal government does, at this point in time, view sexual orientation and gender identity as a component of the sex discrimination under the EEOC. We see that. But that is not providing guidance to our Department of Workforce Services. They're not operating under that assumption. They're not operating under any court decisions that have mandated to them that they define it that way. They look at this statute because they're a state agency of Wyoming. And when they look at our state statutes, what they see is it's not included on the list. If we want to provide protection, Mr. Chairman, in the state of Wyoming to our workers so that they're not discriminated against in the workplace on a basis of gender identity or sexual orientation, we need to pass this legislation to get that done. We can't just wait for the courts to solve all of our problems. We're proactive as a legislature. We're in the equality state. We value these employees, and we want to put our sign out, which indicates that Wyoming is open for business. I'd urge the body to vote for Senate File 153, and I'd call for the question.
Question being called. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I will raise one question that I haven't heard and heard answered. In the enforcement process in this kind of thing, is there anything there that's going to compel an employer to inquire as to somebody's sexual orientation? Because I would think that a number of Wyoming employers are very likely to take the attitude, that's something I neither know nor care about, and I don't want to inquire, and I just soon not know. It doesn't make any difference to their performance in the jobs, none of my business. Is the enforcement process going to require, because it's some kind of quota system or something, that you force an employer to inquire on that issue?
Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely not.
Question.
Are you ready for the question?
Question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator von Fladern's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 153 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 153 has failed Committee of the Whole. Division being called. All those in favor, please rise. All those opposed, please rise. Senate File 153 has failed. Pursuant to our rules, SR 6-5, having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Agar?
No.
No. Anderson?
No.
No. Anselmi Dalton?
Aye.
Aye. Baldwin?
No.
No. Barnard?
No.
No. Boner?
No.
No. Bouchard?
No.
No. Burns?
Aye.
Aye. Case?
No.
No. Christensen? Aye. Coe? Aye. Dockstetter?
No.
No. Driscoll? No. Ellis?
No.
No. Emmerich?
Aye.
Aye. Hastert?
Aye.
Aye. Hicks?
No.
No. Kinski?
No.
No. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer?
No.
No. Moniz?
No.
No. Nethercott?
No.
No. Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
Aye.
Aye. Peterson?
Aye.
Aye. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Aye. Scott?
Aye.
Aye. Von Fladern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger?
No.
No. President Bebout?
No.
No. Closing vote? Closing Vote closed. 13 aye, 17 no.
Senate File 153 has, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Resolution 6-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 123. Would the reading clerk please read the bill? Thank you.
Senate File 123, School Nutrition Pilot Project, an act relating to school district operations, sponsored by Senator Boner. It was referred to committee number 5, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Barnard, Emmerich, Hicks, Meyer, and Moniz, Senator Hicks, chairman. Was re-referred to committee number 2, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Burns, Driscoll, Hastert, Landon, excused, Senator Dockstader, Senator Landon for Senator Burns, chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 169. I'm a little ahead. I'm on Nebraska time or something, Mr. I'm like 2 hours ahead of everybody. Mr. Chairman.
We're on Senate File 123.
Can I take a run at this again?
Please do.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File 123 do pass, and for an explanation of this great little piece of legislation, I'll turn it over to Senator Boner.
Senator Boner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just like to go through the Senate file real quick. This, what we're attempting to do here is to capitalize on some encouraging trends we've seen in our school districts as it relates to their school lunch program, in particular farm-to-school programs. For those of you who are not familiar with this program, this is where school kids, sometimes in conjunction with a more comprehensive curriculum, teach them about agriculture. We'll go and maybe tour a local farm, maybe pick some local produce, and get that local product, that Wyoming product, into their school lunches. And for produce, it makes a lot of sense financially because, after all, even especially if the kids participate in processing the produce, it's very just very cost-effective. You basically don't have any labor costs. Overall, it financially makes sense. That does not apply, however, to any sort of meat product, primarily because of the processing costs associated with getting that animal ready to go and into the school lunch program. So what this piece of legislation is doing is capitalizing on the trends we see in our school districts, where you'll have local producers donating livestock to the school lunch program. This makes it very cost effective, as you may imagine. And so we're attempting to incentivize that at a larger scale throughout the state without micromanaging or telling the school districts how that's going to happen. So the way that we're going to do that is we have a $25,000 appropriation for the upcoming school year to have a 50-50 split with the school districts for those processing costs for a donated animal. So I know that in this body we're awful accustomed to saying, you know, if you spend money up front, you're going to save it later. Maybe that sometimes that's true, maybe sometimes it isn't. But in this particular case, you have to have the savings up front because you have to have the donation up front, and then and only then do you have the expenditure of funds to help with the processing costs. So this can help encourage producers, sometimes several hundred dollars that it takes to, and in some districts they do expect the producers to provide the processing costs as well. That sometimes that can be enough to dissuade a producer from making a donation. So that's what we're trying to do here, is provide a little bit of incentive, a little bit of encouragement for our producers to go ahead and donate those animals, and that's the purpose behind the bill. And so a $25,000 appropriation is going to roughly be enough. If every school district in the state participates, that'd be about a month's worth of beef product throughout the whole state for a 50-50 match for those processing costs. So that's roughly what we're looking at. This is a pilot program just for next school year to see what the interest is, see if maybe we can continue to build this momentum with a more permanent
program in the coming years, but that's what we're doing right here. Also, we do have a Committee of the Whole amendment, which if you could read that in a time, that'd be great.
Would the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole amendment?
Senate File 123, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 15.
Senator Bonner, we are on the amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 123. And actually, this was a product of our discussion in the Appropriations Committee. I was asked if there was any reason we couldn't include game animals, you know, elk, deer, what have you. And I think that was a great idea. I thought that was a great improvement on this program. So that's what this amendment does. You'll see it'll add game meat as one of the type of meats that could be in the school lunch program. So with that, I'll stand for any questions on the amendment.
We're on the Committee of the Whole amendment. Senator Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would question being able to use game meat on school lunches. Game meat has to be processed differently in the processing plants. It can't be intermingled with other meats. I don't think we can even do it.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would stand against this amendment, not because the idea isn't great, but because game meat is not inspected in any shape or form. And there are certain regulations and rules that come down from on high that we can only serve inspected food.
Are you ready for the question? Senator Boner. Senator Boner.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I certainly appreciate the discussion. So I guess vote up, vote down.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Boner's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 123, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 123 has failed. We are back on the bill.
Okay, Senator Bonner. Questions on the bill.
Question on the bill being called. All those in favor of Senator Hicks's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 123 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those no?
No.
Senate File 123 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 155. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 155, Bar and Grill Liquor License Increase, an act relating to alcoholic beverages, sponsored by Senator Burns, was referred to Committee Number 2, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Burns, Dockstader, Hastert, Landon, and conflict, Senator Driscoll. Senator Landon signing for Senator Burns, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Burns?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 155, Bar and Grill Liquor License Increase. There is a Standing Committee Amendment, and I would ask that it be read in.
Would the reading clerk please read the Standing Committee Amendment?
Senate File 155, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 21.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, if you will look on your desks, you'll see a handout that's got a lot of yellow. And that sort of explains the reason for this bill. Mr. Chairman, what this bill basically does is it reorders the schedule for bar and grill licenses in the metropolitan areas, larger metropolitan areas in the state. If you look at this, you'll see that the larger cities have used up all their bar and grill licenses, and it is now starting to pinch on economic development within the state. And a good example was mentioned in this other handout to you. One bar and grill license became available recently in Laramie. 20 people applied for it, 20 different businesses. These are restaurants, not bars. So this is the type of model that we see if you go out on on the busiest street in Cheyenne, and you'll see all these restaurants up and down. That is the model that they keep. But what this bill is actually more aimed at is are not those franchises. That helps, but it's the individual entrepreneurs. And if you go, for instance, to downtown Laramie, most of those restaurants and bar and grill type places are independently owned. That's what we're after. So it's mostly the larger cities and those places that get a lot of tourists. For instance, Laramie, right at the top of page one, was authorized four. They have four. Gillette is full. Even Dubois is full. Again, a touristy type of area. If you go to the second to last page at the bottom, you'll see, and this is for the totals, you'll see that there are 237 bar and grill licenses authorized throughout the state. Only 65 have been issued. That's because when we first did the bar and grill license concept, it was put out to every municipality and in the counties. So places like Hartsville and Claremont and LaGrange all have two or three. They don't really need it. There isn't the need there. And what we did not do was we did not concentrate enough in the metropolitan areas, in the population centers, where they were really needed. Recently, in my own town, within the last year, a liquor license came up that could be given out, and we had eight applicants for that. Fortunately, there's only one winner. The mayor of Laramie came and testified on this bill, and she said that if we had 20, that she could have filled them if she had 20 available. So this is for the economic development of these towns. This is for the entrepreneurship of these towns. And with that, I would like to move on to the Standing Committee Amendment, and I would move the Standing Committee Amendment at this point. Mr. Chairman, when you go on the bill on page 2, you can see what the formula is. It was read in.
I'm sorry, we did read it in.
Never mind. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, this is for towns, only towns over 4,000. And you can see the formula. And at the bottom of page 2, the formula allows for two additional bar and grill licenses for every additional 4,000 people. Well, when you go to the chart, you'll see that the towns of the two largest cities in the state would benefit from that with 16 additional bar and grill licenses. That is not the intent of this bill, and one of the things I did not intend was to hurt the retail liquor license owners. Every time since we've had bar and grill licenses, we have adjusted them up once already. The price of retail liquor licenses still continue to go up. So it's not hurting them. This is meant to be incremental. So on the Standing Committee Amendment, what I do is I cap this off at 6. So the two largest cities in the state will get no more than 6 additional bar and grill licenses. And if they want to get any more, they have to grow another 4,000 population on top of that. And Mr. Chairman, there are many problems with the liquor license laws we have in the state right now and the synthesis that we have and the, I put it earlier in the session, basically a protection racket that the state is running for current retail liquor license owners. And I think it has to be changed at some point. But we, at the same time, we don't want to hurt those people who put their life savings into the licenses that they have. So as I said, that's why this is an incremental increase. And with that, I would be glad to take questions on the Standing Committee Amendment.
We're on Standing Committee Amendment number 1, the Senate File 155. Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 155, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 155 has passed. We are back on the bill. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, with the Standing Committee Amendment now, any increase in bar and grill licenses are now capped at a maximum of six. As I said, it's incremental. I'd be glad to take any other questions on the bill.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question on the calculations, and I think I understand, but what's so magic about the 4 to 12,000 on page 2, lines 6 to 9, and how you adjusted those numbers? Was it based on some information you gathered from various communities in our town, or was it sort of a swag?
Senator Burns.
Mr. President, it was a semi-swag, but it was a line that I put in there that differentiates basically a city from a town in the state of Wyoming. And also, when you look at the majority of bar and grill licenses that aren't being used, they're in municipalities and counties, in municipalities under 4,000. And by the way, I wanted to leave counties out of this entirely.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I signed on to this bill with the good senator, quite frankly, so that we could continue a conversation about a set of our statutes that I think deserves a lot more work in the coming years. We find ourselves in kind of a conundrum when we represent our districts back there, because what happens is you have your young entrepreneurs, your people that want to try to grow things with new ideas, and we're not just talking about the major national chains, Mr. Chairman, that are coming in to our community. We're talking about maybe the young up-and-coming folks of our communities that want an opportunity here. And so you have that on the one side, and then you have the other side where you have the full retail liquor license folks that hold on to these licenses that they had to purchase, in some cases, for up to $200,000 to $500,000 each. And so they're sending emails saying, under no circumstances do you give anybody any more opportunity for any licenses that might compete against me. That's not right either. So I commend the sponsor for bringing the bill so that we can continue this conversation. I have this feeling in my tummy that maybe this deserves an interim study. I mean, I really think that we need a long-term solution to this entire issue of bar and grill licenses and restaurant licenses, and make sure that we have those dispensing rooms. It's got to be walls from the floor all the way to the ceiling on those, and then full retail liquor licenses. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm on the bill for now. I don't know if six is too many or if it's not enough. We can talk about that as we move the bill forward, but I would hope that we would consider, you know, a more comprehensive long-term look at what we're going to do with liquor licenses. Thank you.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Burns's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 155 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no? Senate File 155 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 169. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 169, Migratory Bird Refuge, an act relating to game and fish, sponsored by Senator Dockstader, was referred to Committee Number 6, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Barnard, Boner, Emmerich, and Boniz. Senator Emmerich, Chair.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Emmerich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it do so with favorable consideration of Senate File 169, Migratory Bird Refuge, and for a complete and thorough explanation of this fine little bill, I would yield to Senator Dockstader.
Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the body, bring you 169, Migratory Bird Refuge. Members of the Senate, this was brought to me by my local government back in our county, specifically my commission, Conservation District. They sought to amend the boundary of what's known as the Cokeville Meadows National Wildlife Refuge. Now, the proposal calls, the original proposal calls for a 27,000 acre acquisition. This is along a 23-mile stretch of ag country between Copeville and Sage Junction over there on Highway 30, if you're familiar with that country. They want to keep it at its existing 7,000 acres and allow for some off-site mitigation, some habitat leasing, some candidate conservation projects to take care of any future efforts to help the wildlife there. So I asked them for a list of their concerns, and they said, let us count the ways. And I won't take you through their list of 32 reasons, but rather, you did call for a thorough explanation, so we'll hold off the 32 reasons. But rather than give you all of that, we're going to give you the highlights of their concerns related to the economy, the ag community, sportsmen, water, and mineral rights. Number one, federal budget challenges. The refuge is unable to handle the existing responsibilities they have. That's what they believe, what they've seen. It's federal folks, they're still trying to balance their budget and living off a credit card, so they're having trouble with that. Number two, negative impact to the ranching and ag community in that area. Loss of funding to the local governments, the schools, fire department, hospital, weed and pest districts. Number four, unresponsive to local governments as they discuss planning or possibility. Number five, the federal agency has influenced grazing permits. Number six, wildlife thrived there before the refuge. Now wildlife damages the surrounding cropland and spreads noxious weeds. Number seven, when created, there would be hunting of waterfowl and game. Now, that's been slow improvement, but they said they haven't got that all back like they wanted to, part of the original agreement back in the 90s. Number eight, refuge resulted in the expansion of the brucellosis surveillance area. This is a big concern to the ag community. It's now up to 764,311 acres, to be exact. Number nine, additional brucellosis testing for producers in that area. Number 10, concentration of wildlife has resulted in damages to fences and hay storage in the area. Number 11, removal of dikes, irrigation of various water control infrastructure, all part of the refuge. Number 12, can't create an original natural area. That's what they were trying to do with refuge area because there's an upstream reservoir and there's a railroad that runs right through the middle of it. Number 13, there's mineral rights issues on about 2,900 acres of the 27,000 acres. So in conclusion, members of the Senate, they don't want to shut it down. They just want to look for other abilities to deal with wildlife conservation efforts. And so I bring you Senate File 169.
Question being called. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Emmerich's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 169 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 169 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 138. Yes. Senator Burns.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to remind anybody if their bill is coming up on Committee of the Whole either today or tomorrow and it needs to be re-referred, it has to be re-referred today. And our committee appropriations would be glad to handle it upon adjournment, but today is the last day it can be in committee. So double-check and make sure your bill doesn't need to be re-referred to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Burns. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 138. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 138, Certified Public Accountants Amendments, an act relating to professions and occupations, sponsored by Senator Pappas, was referred to Committee Number 7, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Agar, Case, Nethercott, Pappas, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Case.
138. Mr. Chairman, this is a total delight. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 138, certified public accountant amendments. Perfectly clean bill, great bill, and to talk about the bill, we'd like to yield to Senator Pappas.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a real simple bill. Take us just a few minutes to deal with it, I hope. Basically, what we're doing with this bill, the bill is to reduce the educational hours to sit for the uniform CPA examination from what's currently 150 hours to roughly 120 hours, which equates to a bachelor's degree. So basically what would be what's being accomplished is that to sit for the examination as a Wyoming candidate, the current law requires that you are in the program, you're trying to attain 150 hours, and that you have to be a citizen, a resident of Wyoming, and that you have to have met the age of majority. What this bill will do will allow the minimum, align the minimum education requirements for Wyoming candidates with the other jurisdictions from around the country which have relaxed their minimum educational requirements. I want to impress upon everyone, however, we are not reducing the requirement to get a certificate to be a CPA. That is still 150 hours. What we're merely doing in this bill is allowing Wyoming candidates to take the test while they're either in school or just actually after graduating with their bachelor's degree. They will still have to go on and get 150 hours concentration in accounting to get their certificate. But what we're finding in the society and the board of certified public accountants are seeing that our candidates who are going to school here are finding it easier to go to other states to take the exam because they can do it with a baccalaureate degree. And what happens is that since they've passed the exam in that other state, they tend to be drawn to that state. And so we're losing them from Wyoming. There actually is a fear that with the retirements and CPA in the ranks of the CPAs right now, that there won't be enough candidates to fill our need. So we're asking that we change the requirement to sit for the exam. So if you look at the simple bill, if you look at page one, we're striking on line 12, we're striking most of the first part of the paragraph and adding some new language to the end. So the new language would read, a candidate is eligible to take the examination when he has met the requirements of 33.3.109A, Romanet 1 and 2, and has completed a baccalaureate or higher degree.
You got this one. Question being called.
All those in favor.
I get the point, Mr. Chair.
Senator Case's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 138 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 138 has passed committee of the whole.
Chairman, point of order.
Yes.
I get no respect in this body.
You do look like Rodney Dangerfield. Senator Driscoll.
I need to get on record, declare conflict on SF 155, the liquor bill.
So noted. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ditto.
So noted. The next bill for our consideration. Conflict noted.
Mr. Chairman, point of order. Your conflicts aren't actually noted in committee of the whole. It's true that our rules say that you should declare them now, but there's no report of it.
I got him on.
I'm sorry, but there's no report of it. It's just because the digest has the committee of the whole report.
But it does need to be done, and it's best to do it in committee of the whole, but you have to do it to get the recording by third reading.
Thank you, Senator Case. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's a good point. The Rule 12.2, Rule 12.2 that we just amended, the opportunity or the chance is you should do it as early as you realize that you have it. So even though that's passed, I think it's absolutely in order and appropriate to do it then, because that's when it comes to you've got it, that's, you know, it's, you declare that as early as you can. So I think that's absolutely correct.
The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 28. Would the reading clerk please read the Senate File?
Senate File 128, Revisers Bill, an act relating to the revision of errors in legislation, sponsored by the Management Council, was referred to Committee Number 12, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Hastert, Perkins, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern. Excused, Senator Bebout. Senator Bebout, Chairman.
Yeah, point of order, Mr. Chairman. Be sure and say Senate File 128, not 128.
No, 28.
It is 28, not 128.
Senate File 28, Revisers Bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman.
Senate File 28. Mr. Speaker, Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move the Committee of the Whole write and report to you as a favorable recommendation that Senate File 28 do pass. There's a standing committee amendment I ask to be read in at this time.
Would the reading clerk please read in the Standing Committee Amendment?
Senate File 28, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 10.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Standing Committee Number 1 to explain the Standing Committee Amendment and the bill. I yield to the Vice President.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Every year, for those new here, every year we have a revisers bill, which is the technical corrections that LSO and others find, and, you know, like a number being the wrong reference, being the wrong place, misspelling of a word, whatever. We just put them into this revisers bill, and that's what you get by, sponsored by the management. LSO usually comes to us and says, here's the corrections, we go over them. And then we found, through this amendment, we found other corrections that needed to be done. So if you go through it and you look at page 2, you get they had the wrong reference there. It goes and should have been 359616A9. And then you go down to the bottom of the page and they took out the word justice. I am not sure where that came in and inserted circuit, which it was meant to be. Once again, they had to delete justice again at the bottom of that page and put circuit at the top of the next page. And they had volunteer firemen's on 93426C, and they meant to say firefighter and EMT pensions, and that probably relates to Section B above, which is not printed in here because they did not have to correct it there. 359617 on line 20, page 3, was another correction, correct reference to something. You'll look down on page 4, you'll see on line 18 where they reproduction by his wife under article, and they had originally 8. Their correct reference should have been Article 9 of this act. On page 5, you get down there and you see they spelled United. As in United States, they spelled it wrong, so they corrected that. And on the top of page 6, bottom of 5, and the top of 6, once again, firefighter and EMT needed to be put in there. And the correct statute reference, they struck out 359601, put 359616 in there. Ditto on the next line, slightly different reference, but correct one. Once again, they struck out firemen's and put firefighter and EMT pension account established under the correct statute reference again, because they had the incorrect one. And or the other one was, it might happen that the other one was deleted out in a bill, and nobody ever corrected it further in the statute. So this is the correction that needs to be made. They, on page 7, line 10, they struck out Director of the Department of Education, put State Superintendent. Page 8, they struck out, had to add the word than, not more than 75%. Page 8, once again at the bottom, last line, irregardless is not a word. They
struck that out and put regardless in there. And correct reference again on page 9, line 6, change the reference, and or it was removed by another bill, and so they had to put the reference in there, the correct one. And on page 10, yeah, correction on the bill. Question, no. Let me explain this.
Mr.
And there's an amendment with the other corrections. So we're voting on the amendment, sir.
We did move the amendment. The amendment has been moved.
Yes.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 28, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 28 has passed. We are back on the bill. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I rise to raise significant objection to part of this bill. If you look on page 10, there's a whole series of things starting on page 10, runs all the way over to page 12, I think. I've been able to determine so far that the items on 3525-104 are inconsistent both as to style and substance with Senate File 67 that we passed through this committee. Department brought those but corrections to us, but they're different from what's in here. Mr. Chairman, I haven't been able to track everything else back in here. There are some things the department regards as corrections that your committee number 10 in the past has regarded as unfortunate and unwise substantive changes, and I can't determine whether that's here or not. It has to do with what we do if there isn't enough money, transforms it into an entitlement as opposed to a limited program. So it's fundamental. And in addition, on the Standing Committee amendment, having just seen it, I haven't been able to track it back, but there's a correction to 26-19-307, and I suspicion that the interim committee bill, which is, I think, started on the other side, may have eliminated that, repealed that provision. So I'm not quite sure how to handle that. My temptation is going to be to ask, maybe on second reading, that we remove the stuff with regard to the child health insurance program. I don't have much confidence in what's going on here.
Senator Bebout and then Senator Rothfuss.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If the senator from Natrona County is talking about a bill that's in the process and it could violate or be different than what we show in this particular bill, what happens? This goes to the House and is saved till the very end, and then we make all the cross-reference to ensure that anything that's passed this session, this would be the last thing that we do. As to inadvertent mistakes that have been made because someone has an ulterior motive, if you have specifics, we'll go back to our staff that prepared this, and we'll ask them to verify that. I can't speak to that. Maybe other members of the Rules Committee could do that. We looked at this. We didn't go through it line by line carefully to go back and see what they may have had as far as their interpretation relative to the statutes we passed. But as to the others, I think we catch them at the end. That's why we always do the revisor's bill.
What he said. Question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation in Senate File 28 do pass, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. Senate File 28 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 121. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 121, Wyoming Pharmacy Act Amendments, an act relating to the Wyoming Pharmacy Act, sponsored by Senator Baldwin, was referred to Committee Number 7, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senator Agar, Case, Nethercott, Pappas, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 121, Wyoming Pharmacy Act Amendments. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment I'd ask that be read in.
Would the reading clerk please read in the standing committee amendment?
Senate File 121, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 9.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when I move the standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 121 and ask that the chairman yield my time to Senator Baldwin.
Senator Baldwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It gives me great delight to be the final bill today. You should give all delight, right? Let's get the amendment out of the way to start with and get it read. The amendment, if you'll look at it in front of you, it does a lot of things, but it does a lot of things in the bill repeatedly. One of the things it does, anywhere in your bill, it says doctor or provider. It changes that to current language. It says practitioner. We're talking about those who are able to write prescriptions. One of the other things it does, when it's talking about disciplinary measures, as on your amendment on line 13 of your amendment, when it talks about those who are disciplined, rather than just be disciplined for a jaywalking or a shoplifting, we put disciplined by a board of pharmacy to make that more appropriate to pharmacists to have their license revoked, although maybe they should be revoked if they shoplift. But we won't address that right now. The big things on the amendment are on your amendment lines 20 through 26, as well as one of the first ones there on page 1, line 10. We deleted any language that had to do with biosimilars, biosimilar being the language that we're going to deal with in the interim or some other time. It was a complex issue. All the departments and everybody that dealt with this, I'm not a big believer in kumbaya moments, but I believe we had a heck yes moment. We said, let's do it later and get it out of this bill, and everybody was happy because it made the bill shorter. So you can cross off all those things on at least four pages there that has to do with biosimilars. The only other thing it does, it has a couple of grammatical corrections. The Board of Pharmacy no longer has an undergraduate degree for pharmacists, so we took that out of the language. And that's pretty much what the amendment does. It just makes a lot of corrections to bring everything up to date and with language. With that, I'd like to go ahead and get the amendment out of the way.
Question. Question being called on the amendment. All those in favor of Senator Baldwin's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 121, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 121 has passed Committee of the Whole. We are back on the bill. Senator Baldwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's work through this real quickly. On this page 2, you will find that we changed the prescription from being 2 years old to 1 year old, being able to be honored. Wyoming was one of the few states, if not the only state, that was still honoring prescriptions that were 2 years old. To match other states, we're revising that to say 1 year old. So if your prescriptions are more than 1 year old, you need to go get a new one. And if you work through the next couple pages, on page 3, no longer are they called examiners, Board of Pharmacy examiners. A correct terminology is just Board of Pharmacy and not examiners of the state. So on line 17, we remove that. On page 4, you just see some of those recurrent. The other things, on line 3 of page 4, you'll see that the current terminology is not dangerous drugs, rather the current terminology in pharmacology is termed prescription drugs. And you will see that correction recurrent through the bill as well. And there on page 5, you will see we corrected the Food Administration to the Food and Drug Administration, which is correct terminology. And we changed the undergraduate degree on page 5. And as we move through the rest, some of this is just correction. On page 6, it talks about a notification of a foreshed shall be made to the address furnished. They just put that as language. They do it in whatever way is available. They do it by Internet, but they notify rather than call it by mail. And on that same page, you'll see at the next scheduled meeting for reexamination, there is no reexamination. If they flunk, they will make the arrangements to have it. There's not a scheduled reexamination date. And finally, as we work through the rest of the bill, there's all those recurrent ones. If you violate the Board of Pharmacy rules rather than a jaywalking, on the bottom of page 8, page 9, you'll see the board may allow hours completed 1 year to be credited to another year. They don't do that currently. They require the credits for CMEs, continuing medical education, be acquired in that year and applied to that year. They're required a small number. I believe she told us 12. She says they currently don't have any problems with people doing that, and if they do, they have a disciplinary major. And then we move through written application on page 11 is stricken out. It's an online application. It doesn't have to be a written application anymore, so they just corrected that. Page 12, this is an old thing. They used to, the pharmacist would be allowed, if a drug cost less, he could dispense it rather than the more expensive, and that's totally changed now. They are allowed to dispense a generic drug, but a lot of things like Wyoming Medicaid or other Medicaids have formularies where sometimes the more costly is prescribed because of a deal or a license or contract that particular group has through pharmacy. So that rule there on lines 8, 9, and 10 doesn't apply anymore. And then on you get onto the pages 13, 14, 15, and 16, all the way down to line 17 on page 16. That was taken out because of the biosimilar language. That's something we'll deal with on another time. Moving through just the rest of the bill, most of this is just corrections that you've already seen. The disciplinary measures there on page 17. We changed that to the Federal Drug Administration to the Food and Drug Administration, which is correct terminology. And the big reason and the reason that this bill was even brought up, you see on page 19, pedigree drugs. Pedigree drugs is a terminology not used anymore. They don't exist. And so they have a different method. They used to have to do a pedigree, like you would pedigree your AKC dog, and they don't do that anymore. They have a method. They follow how it's dispensed, and they dig back into that. So pedigree drug is a antique term, and they don't use that. So you'll see on page 19, anything that referred to pedigree is gone. This corrects some of the things except for the biosimilar drugs, which we will correct at a future date. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'd encourage an aye vote.
Question.
Oh, real quick.
Senator
just
Meyer.
Quick discussion about why the prohibition of the two-year script going to a one-year script just because other states are doing it. If a medical doctor says, here's a two-year script, why does the Board of Pharmacy want to intervene between the patient and the doctor? Or is that what's going on or what's going on?
What's going on? Senator Baldwin.
No, and to answer the good senator, that's not at all what's going on. The fact of the matter being, there's a number of reasons here. The pharmacy and the drug industry is changing very, very quickly. The reason being a two-year prescription doesn't work when, and an example was given in committee, as a matter of fact, when a doctor leaves or when a practitioner leaves, that person then has to find a new doctor, and we give them a year to do that. The one-year prescription is sufficient. I speak as a practitioner here. We feel that people need to come in every year. To do a two-year prescription is excessive to keep track of that patient and make sure that patient is compliant and doing what they need to do. So 1 year across the industry is considered standard. And Wyoming is actually doing that, and it will tell you. It's just something that was in the old Board of Pharmacy rules and regs. It's something that they're really not doing. They're saying a year.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 121 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 121 has passed committee of the whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee of the whole rise and report.
You have heard.
That's all.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader's motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Reading clerk, please read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under considerations bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 140, do pass. Senate File 125, do pass. Senate File 156, do pass. Senate File 131, do pass amended. Senate File 146, do pass. Senate File 152, do pass. Senate File 153, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senate File 123, do pass. Senate File 155, do pass amended. Senate File 169, do pass. Senate File 138, do pass. Senate File 28, do pass amended. Senate File 121, do pass amended. Senator Wasserberger, Chairman.
Senator Wasserberger.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report is adopted. Standing Committee reports.
February 2nd, 2017, Mr. Presidential Committee Number 8, to whom was referred Senate File 170, Unmanned Aircraft, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senator Agar, Anderson, Baldwin, Christensen, and Meyer. Senator Meyer, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, I believe that clears my desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. Before I make the motion, I think we're down. We're trying to figure that out. I think we're somewhere around 8 bills or so left. How many? 7?
11.
11?
Oh, 7.
See? Don't argue with the majority of Florida. I mean, we're keeping track of this. We're monitoring this. So anyway, I think we're down. Like I say, we're down around 8 bills. So some of them will have some. I think some of them would be for some fairly extensive debate. We will also we're going to come in tomorrow at 8:45 when I make the motion. So we're going to start tomorrow at 8:45. 8:45, and we'll the majority party will caucus before we go to second reading tomorrow. So probably for about 30 minutes, trying to keep that down to about 30 minutes. But anyway, with that, Mr. President, let's know people where we are. So, with that, I move that we stand adjourned until 8:45 tomorrow, which is February the 3rd.
Announcements. Senator Burns.
Mr. President, your committee number 2, appropriations, will meet down in L-55 about 10 minutes from now, where we will take up re-referred Senate File 95, early retirement, and re-referred Senate 149, continuation of Special Districts Task Force.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. sharp in Jonah Room S-27. House Bill 211, Developmental Preschool Payment Calculation Amendments, and, if time permits, House Bill 92, Payment of Wages Upon Termination Time Limit.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Judiciary Committee number 1 will meet tomorrow morning, Friday the 3rd, 8 a.m. at Jonah S-18, to consider the following House bills. House Bill 18, Child Abuse or Neglect in Military Families. House Bill 152, Engrossed Search and Rescue Operations.
Any other announcements? You heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. The Senate is adjourned until 8:45 tomorrow, Friday, February 3rd.